Hello and welcome to the 150th episode of the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here as always to talk about stuff. 150 episodes, Sean.
That's a lot. That's a lot of episodes.
Is it too many episodes?
It's one was too many episodes, Jonathan. So yes, 150 is too many episodes.
Okay, it's crazy. We're not doing like a special 150 based thing today, but we're talking about a lot of different things we really like.
Yeah, it's an anniversary episode in a lot of different ways.
It really is, and I think really the next big milestone is when we hit 200, we'll have to do our top 200 stuff list.
Yeah, which and I think we should probably start working on that now.
Probably a good idea, yeah.
Because that sounds like a lot of work.
Because it'll probably be like next summer if we can stick to this weekly thing.
Yeah, Jesus.
Which we've been good at this year. I know we missed last week.
But we did two podcasts last week, and one of them was five podcasts long.
I had to, like, honestly, I thought about texting you over the last weekend and being like, do you want, and then I'm like, I'm too tired. I don't have any more to say.
Yeah, like, I was still recuperating from E3.
It was crazy. So I hope you guys enjoyed those podcasts. We enjoyed talking about them. Today on the docket, our main topic is going to be June 23rd was the 25th anniversary of Sonic the Hedgehog. That is when Sonic the Hedgehog 1 came out for the Sega Genesis.
Yes.
Also, I'm going to need therapy to figure out this coincidence.
Yeah.
June 23rd, 1991 is also the day my parents got married.
Okay.
It was also their 25th wedding anniversary.
Okay.
That's just, it's a weird thing that they have the exact same anniversary dates as Sonic the Hedgehog. To the day.
Yeah, that's strange.
I don't know how to feel about that.
I don't know how I can help you through that.
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay.
It feels like you're going to have to, like, climb a mountain or something and just and meditate for a day.
There's that Rocky Mountain Zen Buddhism Center.
Yeah,
literally in the mountains. I think that would be a good place to figure this out.
Yeah, I think so. You should do that.
All right, but we're going to talk about Sonic. We're also, I'm not exactly sure how we're going to do this, but we're going to do a little mini topic maybe also. This week was also the 20th anniversary of the Nintendo 64.
Yeah.
And, man, it's us as video game players. There aren't two things much more formative for us than the N64 and Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, Sonic the Hedgehog 3 for the Sega Genesis was the first game I really fell in love with when I was, like, a little kid. And then the Nintendo 64 with, like, Super Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time were, like, the other two, like, really formative games when I was, like, a couple of years older.
It's been weirdly nostalgic for me thinking about this stuff. Another weird coincidence. Yesterday, I was in the house of the person who I first played Sonic Adventure 2 with. So I was in the house, and I was like, that's where I first saw Sonic Adventure 2.
Huh.
Their TV right there. It was a different TV. It was a full-screen TV 15 years ago. But he was playing Sonic Adventure 2, and they're moving, so we were having a moving away party. And it was just weirdly, because I had not played a Sonic game before that. So it was like, that's where I first met Sonic the Hedgehog. And it was Cityscape, and I heard Cityscape.
Yeah.
One of the many great tracks in the Sonic music au revoir. And it's like, so I don't know, it's just been weirdly nostalgic thinking about that, the N64, which was my first console, all this stuff, so.
Yeah, and like, also, it was sort of like weird timing thing with that anniversary stuff for me, is that at my house, with my mom, we have been like, kind of going through stuff and organizing a lot of stuff, and so, like a week or two ago, I organized all my old video game stuff and put them in a cabinet and sort of like, categorized everything, found all the bits and pieces that were hidden around the house, and just sort of consolidated everything. So I've been having like a weird nostalgia thing of going through and like plugging in our old N64 and being like, does this thing still fucking work? And it does. And Pokemon Snap is still a pretty good game.
Because awesome.
I played a little bit of Pokemon Snap.
That's great. No, there's nothing better than talking about this stuff. So I'm excited to get into this. But first, a couple of just stuff things. I've seen and watched and played some stuff I've really loved in these last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I want to talk about a couple of those. And I have to start with a mea culpa.
Okay.
To Pixar.
Yeah.
Because
I feel like we do this a lot.
We do this. I'm done second guessing them. Because we made fun of Finding Dory.
It's still a silly concept.
It is. Everything about Finding Dory is a bad idea on paper. And I think even they might agree with that.
Yeah.
That is a great movie. I saw that movie. It is fantastic. And I don't even know where to start. It was like, it's such a good sequel, but it's not really a sequel. Like, that's the first thing to know, is that it is Dory-centric, but it's not a repeat of the first movie. Like, even though it's called Finding Dory, it's not they have to go find Dory. That's not,
right.
It's more like the philosophical she has to find herself kind of thing. And so they really, other than Marlin, Nemo, and Dory, and a brief cameo by the Turtles, those are the only characters from the first movie who come back.
Hmm.
And other than that, it's all new characters, it's new places. It's not in any way the plot setup of the first movie. They basically bypass the whole ocean journey thing in the first act. We don't even really see it, and then they get where they're going, and then the movie is all at the destination where they are, because Dory is looking for her parents. And that alone is kind of interesting to me, because it makes the movie much more, to me, like a sister film than it is a sequel. Because it's not... Dory is now the protagonist, so like that role has kind of shifted, where Marlon is in the supporting role.
Right.
And just like the tone of the movie and everything, it's a very smart sequel in that it's not just trying to do what the first movie did. And weirdly, I think Pixar does try to do this. Like, if you look at their recent sequels, Cars 2, Monsters University, and this, none of them are retreads of the first movie.
Yeah.
Some of them work better than others.
Yes, yeah.
Cars 2, I will always contend, it's not a bad movie. I do think Pixar has made a bad movie in The Good Dinosaur. I don't think Cars 2 is a bad movie. I think it's a funny movie. It's not a great movie.
Okay.
Monsters University, very funny. Probably not a great movie, but a pretty good movie. Finding Dory, I can't decide if I think it's a great Pixar movie or not, but I don't care because it's such a good one.
Okay, like, yeah.
It's, for one, it is really, really funny. And I think this is something I've noticed about Pixar in kind of their advanced age now, is ever since Toy Story 3, they've had sort of more middling movies in terms of how good their stories and characters are.
Yeah.
But they've been consistently very funny. Like, they've gotten even better at just straight humor than I think they ever were before. Like, Monsters University is a screamingly funny movie at parts, even if its story is kind of lackluster in areas, because it's sure. a kind of typical college kind of movie. No, like, a kid's college movie.
Yeah, not, yeah. Not, yeah, not like National Lampoon's no. Monsters University, but yeah.
Although that would be really interesting, too.
Yeah, if Pixar just decided to make an R-rated comedy, sure.
You know John Goodman would be up for it.
Yeah.
No. So they've been really funny, and I think Finding Dory is... This is a gut reaction. I think it's their funniest movie. I could not stop laughing at that movie. There are some parts where I was embarrassed for how loud I was laughing in the theater, although everyone else was laughing too, so it's right. okay. But it's just some of the characters they meet. Idris Elba plays a seal, and
okay.
he is so funny. And he has a rivalry with this, like, basically mentally challenged seal who wants to share his rock. It's very funny stuff. And so the whole movie is just very funny. But it also has, I think, a heart that has been kind of missing from a lot of Pixar's recent movies, other than Inside Out, which is a different kind of thing, because that's so
yeah.
good. And it's consistent. Like, I think Monsters University has a phenomenal ending, where, like, I think the last 20 minutes of Monsters University are some of the best 20 minutes Pixar has ever done. The rest of the movie does not rise to that level. Finding Dory is consistently emotional and interesting on a character level. And again, it's everything about it, if I just say it, sounds like a bad idea. So the plot is Dory one day remembers her parents. And right. she figures out, oh, I had a family. I think I know where they are. I want to go find them. That is literally the plot to several direct-to-video Disney sequels.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, several of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you hear that, and you're like, I don't know, guys. That doesn't sound like a good idea. It's a great idea, the way they do it, because they keep having these little flashbacks as she goes through her journey to Dory as a little fish with her parents. And every one of those, I was just saying to myself, I can't believe I'm watching cutesy animated fish, and I'm getting this emotional, because they do such a good job with it, basically the allegory being it's two parents with a child who has some kind of disability
yeah.
and trying to deal with that and make her feel at home and giving her this love and support that you realize over the course of the movie, even though she forgot them, none of that left her. So, like, there is a moment where they reveal the origin of her Just Keep Swimming song. Oh my God, that is one of the hardest, like, punches Pixar has ever landed. And again, that shouldn't be a good idea. We don't need an origin to the Just Keep Swimming yeah. song, but the way they do it is so well done. I loved the hell out of this movie. I think there's a little narrative looseness here and there where in the second act, they don't quite know what to do with Marlin and Nemo because it's not really their story. And I was thinking, maybe they should have just kind of left those characters behind and it could just be Dory-centric. And then in the third act, it snaps into place. I'm like, okay, I see why they did that. And it's very well done. All the voice acting. I've always thought in Finding Nemo, Albert Brooks and Ellen DeGeneres, those are the two best performances in any Pixar movie.
Yeah, they're very good.
Yeah, and yeah. they're Ellen DeGeneres is even better here. Like, to the degree where that performance is evidence to me of why voice acting should be eligible for Oscars and awards and stuff.
Yeah.
Because I don't think you're going to see a more complete character creation than Ellen DeGeneres as Dory anywhere this year. Live action, animation, whatever. It is so good. She is so good. there are moments in this movie that feel so stressful because Dory will be on her own and she can't remember things, and they really go into it. Like, in a way where in Finding Nemo, it's mostly a joke.
Yeah.
And then there's that one moment near the end of Finding Nemo where she's on her own again and she gets really kind of stressed and sad because of this. And it feels like they took that and made a movie out of it. And that's why you would make the sequel, is if you want to explore that more. And so there's some scenes where you're just... you love that character so much, and it becomes so stressful and engaging. And again, it's an animated fish.
Yeah.
So, but it's great. And I didn't even realize the nostalgia I think I had for Finding Nemo until this movie started. Because that movie is 13 years old.
Yeah.
It's 2003. Yeah. It's the same year as Return of the King. You know? It's crazy. And Finding Nemo was, if you were around then, a huge phenomenon.
Oh, God, yes.
Like, Pixar has never had a single movie that was that big. A hit, one, and then a phenomenon. Like, I think other Pixar movies, Toy Story 3 has outgrossed it nominally, but if you adjust it for inflation, it's not even close. And that movie was just in theaters forever. I got sick of it at one point because it's the only DVD we had in my middle school or high school.
Yeah, no. That is, even though I did see Finding Nemo in the theater and I remember really liking it the first time I saw it, my memories of Finding Nemo are sitting in a fucking biology classroom. Yes. When the teacher just didn't know what to do anymore, so she just played Finding Nemo. And was like, I've seen Finding Nemo like 5 times already in school. I can't watch it again in this context.
I know, and it's too bad because it does a disservice to the movie, which
it's a bad venue to watch any film, is when you're tired at 8 in the morning in a fucking biology class.
Or in Spanish class. I've seen it in Spanish.
Yeah, I've seen Shrek was the Spanish movie of choice for whatever reason.
That's also how I saw Ice Age 3. Was in Spanish.
Maybe that made the movie better.
Probably. You couldn't make it worse, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Anyway, just realizing that with Finding Dory at the beginning, seeing those characters again, they do a brief reprise of a scene from Finding Nemo. And I was like, oh man, I kind of grew to hate the movie just because it was shown to me in the wrong context so many times. But I loved this film. It was a big part of my childhood. And it's cool to see it again. And it's just... you know, I went to see it. It was the second weekend it was out, so obviously fewer people going to see it. But still, like, just the cross-generational intersect that went to see that movie and why it's been such a big hit is you have the kids who were kids at the time,
yeah,
the adults who were adults at the time, and the now multiple generations of children who have grown up with that movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, yeah, Finding Dory, I think, could come out of this year as the highest grossing movie anywhere.
Jeez.
And it's really good, so that helps. But yeah, it is such a good movie. In terms of nostalgia, one of the things I noticed right off the bat, though, is that because it's been 13 years, animation has come a really long way, particularly where things like water and texture are concerned.
Yeah.
And so it was a little disorienting at first to see Dory and Marlin and those characters with more detail than they had 13 years ago. Like, you can kind of see scales on them. And it was like, I had to be like, that's wrong. Oh, my God. Like, and it's not a complaint. I do think there were parts in the movie where they went with the background details a tad too photorealistic. And if just to make it fit with Finding Nemo, I might have downgraded that a little bit.
Yeah, because Finding Nemo in my memory has like a very kind of like pastel look, you know?
And mostly they keep that. There are some parts, particularly when there's like grains of sand and stuff, where I think they could have done it more cartoony.
Hmm.
Small complaint, obviously Pixar is pushing the envelope. The short before Finding Dory, which is really good, it's called Piper, and it's about this little bird on the beach. It pushes things to a realm of photorealism I don't know if we've ever seen in CGI, and it's very interesting. And I think Pixar needs to be careful with that, because that's honestly part of what ruined The Good Dinosaur, is it had photorealistic backgrounds to the point where the movie just looks like they went and shot plates.
Yeah.
And then it's got super, super, super cartoony dinosaurs, and I just could not get into that movie because... That's not how you do animation.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting problem. I think like video games are kind of running into a similar thing where you can replicate reality to a degree that is significant enough that like you have to really stop and ask, do we want to pursue this thing anymore? Because we've pushed it to the point where it's like, for some things, it's fine and it needs to be like that. But it's not like you need to keep on pushing the technology because you can't hit what you want to hit anymore.
Right.
Sometimes you need to like take a step back and say like, well, maybe we should make this character model slightly less detail oriented because it draws focus to the wrong details in the image.
Absolutely. And I just think, especially because Pixar is leading the field in this stuff and they always have in CGI, it's something I think they should be conscious of.
Yeah.
And I'm interested to see, as we see some other sequels to really old movies, like they are doing The Incredibles 2.
Yeah.
The Incredibles was the breakthrough movie on figuring out how to do humans in CGI. But it was also done with 2005 technology, where how they broke through was realizing we not only can't do human-based texture, we shouldn't try.
Yeah.
And they made it work, and that's always been kind of a high watermark. You can technically do that now, though. And so I'm really interested to see what Brad Bird does with that, because by the time Incredibles 2 comes out, I think that'll be like 15 years after that movie.
Man, what if they do just go for like a hyper-photoreal, like it looks like that awful Beowulf movie?
Yes.
This is like, they just like motion capture the actors, and you're like, what the fuck?
That would be terrible. I mean, they're also doing Toy Story 4. They could do it for that. Motion capture Woody.
No, they should just do stop motion toys for his Toy Story 4. That'd
it's,
be awesome.
That is the one series. Toy Story series is really interesting because, part of the reason they made Toy Story was because CGI looks plasticky.
Yeah.
Toys are plastic. Mm-hmm. And so you don't really see the evolution as much with the Toy Story movies because you can't make plastic look better in CGI, really.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to see how that goes. But like I said, Finding Dory, it's so good. I have not seen a lot of movies in the theater this year, so that's my caveat. It's my favorite movie I've seen in the theater this year, pretty easily.
It's better than Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice?
It is. Are we going to review the R-rated extended cut, Sean?
Fuck no. I know we did that stupid thing when the Prometheus-like extended thing came out.
Prometheus is a much better movie.
Yeah, like there is no way I'm ever touching Batman v Superman again.
No.
Like not even close.
But anyway, so I really loved Finding Dory, and I'm so happy I can say that, and it does make me just take a step back and be like, all right, I think Pixar knows what they're doing.
Until the Good Dinosaur 2 comes out.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, they've got Toy Story 4 and Incredibles 2, and do I feel like I need a Toy Story 4 or Incredibles 2 right now? No. But I would have said that much more emphatically about Finding Dory, so...
I would say I want an Incredibles 2. I don't know about Toy Story 4.
Yeah. No,
Incredibles 2 sounds awesome.
It's always been the most sequel-ready of their movies.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so, it's just like, there's so much potential for another Incredibles movie.
I absolutely think so, and I kind of... Finding Dory is done, like, it's set 6 months after the last movie. I hope for Incredibles 2 they do, like, real passage of time.
Yeah, me too.
Like, the kids are adults and stuff. I think that could be super fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And I trust Brad Bird pretty implicitly. He's a smart, smart guy. All right, so that's Finding Dory. One other thing I have to rave about that I did not think I would even experience. Kirby Planet Robobot for the Nintendo 3DS is a phenomenal fucking game.
Kirby games tend to be pretty good, in my experience.
They do. I have not ever really sunk my teeth into one that hard. I did play... whatever the N64 one is, I forget.
Crystal Dreams, I think.
Yeah, Crystal Shards or something.
Crystal Shards, something like that.
I've played that as a kid. I've played Kirby Air Ride on the GameCube. That was one of my favorite kind of off-the-map GameCube games.
Right.
But Kirby has had a series of games in recent years that have all gotten good reception. I've just never gone into it. And then this Planet Robobot came out earlier this month, and not a ton of people like covered and reviewed it, but everyone who did was like, this is a really good game.
Yeah.
Like, this is surprisingly really good. And, like, just on Reddit forums and stuff where I look for 3DS news, people were like, why is no one talking about this game? And I'm like, okay, I had been in between video games the last few weeks. I could have kind of played The Witcher, but I'm just not in the mood for it at the moment. You kind of have to be ready to play 30 hours of The Witcher. So I'm like, yeah, that sounds light and fun. I'm going to play Kirby Planet Robobot. So I downloaded it last night, started playing it, absolutely blown away. Like, Nintendo is in kind of an unspoken golden era for platformers at the moment, where I feel like every year since 2010 or so, they have had one standout platformer that would be or has been on my top 10 every year. And so, like, I think 2010 was Mario Galaxy 2. I think 2011 was Mario 3D Land. Those are both great.
Yeah.
Then we had in 2012 Mario 3D World on the Wii U. I might be have the dates off.
Yeah, I know that would not be 2012.
I don't think that's not right. That was probably 2013. 2014 was Captain Toad's Treasure Tracker. Last year we had Yoshi's Woolly World. So just they have a bunch of these where they don't get a ton of attention, some of them. Like Mario Galaxy 2 obviously did. That's a classic. But some of those newer ones have not been getting a ton of attention, but they're really good. And like Yoshi's Woolly World last year was, it was on my top 5 games of the year, I think. I really liked that one.
Yeah.
Kirby Planet Robobot is better than several of those. And it's so good, and it has such immense technical prowess behind it that I'm kind of... I think if Nintendo had a console worth supporting, a home console worth supporting, this would be a no-brainer to be a console game.
Right.
Like, it's fine on the 3DS. It makes really good use of it. But there's a lot of it where I'm like, this game is so gorgeous. The music is so good. The gameplay is so tight. I kind of wish I was playing this in HD on a big screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think if they had a better console that people owned...
Yeah, if they had a console that wasn't just sinking right now.
Yes, I think it could be on that. But no, Planet Robobot is so good. And I think for some people, if they've played the last few Kirby games, I guess it's kind of iterative on that. So it's not all new stuff. But, you know, so you have the basics where Kirby can suck in enemies and he's got lots of different abilities.
Yeah.
And I love the way they do that, where at any time you can pause the game and on the top screen there's a control panel or a control screen that shows you what this ability set is, all the moves. It's almost like a fighting game. Like you can see all your move sets. And that's kind of fun that they do that. But then the big twist with this game is robots, like a robot alien species has invaded Kirby's planet. And I love, it's like a 90-second cutscene at the beginning, and then that's it. You're just playing the game. They do not fuck around, and I love that.
Do they ever address the narrative reason for calling it Robobot?
No.
Because that, like, I am all into what you are saying, but I cannot get behind the name Planet Robobot.
I
hate that.
I think it's part of why this game isn't getting more attention. It's not a great title.
It's a fucking awful title. Like, what is Robobot? That's just such a weird thing to do.
Anyway, so you have these mech suits, basically, you can get into. And the base mech suit is pretty cool. You know, you can punch, you can do double jumps and stuff. But then the mech suit can suck in enemies, and it has a whole different set of power-ups. So they're not the same. Like... You know, normal Kirby has the sword, and he's got, like, a poison hat, and he's got electric. He's got so many. But then Robo Kirby has, like, a fire thing. He gets giant chainsaws on his arms.
Okay.
He can fly. All these different things. And every individual level so far, I'm almost through World 2, basically, at this point. Again, I've only had it since last night.
Yeah.
But I'm through World 2 at this point, and every level is really big, very unique. There's, like, no repetition in how these levels play or work. Really well thought out, super fun to play through, and they all make really good use of different abilities and stuff. Not in a way that feels like you're railroaded, like you have to use this here, but in a way where whatever is kind of being introduced in that level that you can use, and there's always lots of options, there's lots of fun ways to implement that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's just super fun to play through. The graphics are incredible for the 3DS, and it is one of the best uses of the 3D on the 3DS I've ever seen. Like, I have kept the 3D on full blast the entire time I've played it. It kind of reminds me of Mario 3D Land in that I think it would be significantly harder to play in 2D because while it's a side-scroller, every screen has at least two planes of depth and action, and you're often kind of going in between them in certain ways.
Right. It's a 2.5D game.
It sort of is, and there's even stuff like where I realized today there's some lasers that'll come down, but they come down at an angle. And you can jump over them because they hit the ground at one point, but then they're in the air, so you can jump over them.
Right.
And I'm like, would I have realized that if I were playing this in 2D and I switch it to 2D? No, you couldn't see it that way. So that is very interesting to me, and I'm glad, because if you've got your 3D system, might as well do it.
Yeah, might as well use it, yeah.
Yeah, and certain 3DS games have done very well by that, and having the new 3DS where it's like the much more stable 3D makes it really nice to play. And the music in this fucking game, oh my god. Kirby has always had great music. You know, honestly, the Kirby soundtrack is the basis of the Smash Bros. Soundtrack, because...
Yeah, that's true.
It's all HAL Laboratories. Mm-hmm. The same people make both sets of games. And so you have some, if you've ever played Smash Bros., some of this will be very familiar to you. But then they've just got all this awesome new music. Like when you first get in the mech suit in this game, the song that plays, I played that level twice in a row, partially to try to find collectibles, but really because I wanted to hear the music again.
Hmm.
And it was so awesome. Just all the music is so good. Like, and this has been a year with some very good soundtracks. Hmm. Like every game that I'm looking at in like my top 10 right now, they all have pretty goddamn good soundtracks.
Yes, yes, they do.
This might be up there as like number one or two. It's so
good. Doom.
Doom is great.
Doom's soundtrack is amazing.
It is. It is. So is Uncharted 4. So is Digimon Story.
Yeah.
Everything's good. But so is Fire Emblem Fates. I got a fucking 8-disc soundtrack for that. This is just so good. It makes you. It's the kind of music where you want to play the game. Because the game is good, but also because you just want to hear the music. Like, it makes it hard to put down.
Yeah.
Like, I really, last night, I finished downloading at like 10:30, and I was pretty tired, and I thought I might just kind of look at it and play it later. I played through all of World 1 in one sitting, because I just loved the music so much. To the point where, like, at the end, my eyes were kind of straining, you know? Because I was up later than I probably wanted to be because my dog had woken me up at 6 that day because she didn't want to be alone. Anyway, that happens. But anyway, so Kirby Planet Robobot, bad title, great game. If you own a 3DS, it is an absolute must own. This is just an inventive, interesting, beautiful platformer. I love the shit out of it. Holy crap. I love that the 3DS, even in its kind of advanced age, can just be delivering knockouts like this.
Yeah.
And it reminds you that even though all of our attention is on Nintendo's home console shenanigans,
yeah,
they've always been better for since like the year 2000 at the handheld stuff. And that is, if you want good games, that's really where your attention should be paid, because they've had a pretty steady stream of that on the 3DS, and it continues even in this year when everything seems pretty quiet. We've already had Fire Emblem Fates, we have this, we have the Dragon Quest remakes coming out, we have Pokemon Sun and Moon. Pretty good year for the 3DS.
Yeah, yeah, so, definitely all things considered with what's going on the console side for Nintendo's business.
They have nothing on the console side.
Paper Mario Color Splash, Jonathan.
I mean, the big release this week was Tokyo Mirage Sessions Sharp FE, which I was going to play, and I just wasn't quite in the mood, so I kind of canceled my pre-order. And because the reviews are good, but not, I don't know.
They seem pretty good, like pretty outstanding for a JRPG.
No, they're ridiculous. Absolutely outstanding. I just don't know if it's the kind of game I wanted to play right now.
Right, yeah. I really want to play that game, but I don't have Wii U.
No, I will get it, and I will play it before the end of the year. It's absolutely part of my plan, but I'm just not playing it at the moment. So
that is an example of a batshit insane title that I think actually kind of works for it.
No, absolutely. And let me tell you why I didn't want to jump into a like 60-hour JRPG.
Yeah.
Because my other project right now is I've been rewatching Dragon Ball Z.
Okay, that's it. That is... Project is the right word for that.
It's a project.
As someone who, in the last, like, 3 years, rewatched all of that stuff in Japanese.
Yeah.
It is a project.
No, absolutely. And I have obviously seen most of Dragon Ball Z several times.
Yes.
I have not, since I got my beautiful Dragon Box sets that I love, some of my most prized possessions, I have not sat down and watched through all of those back to front.
Okay,
yeah. And back to front, I mean... No,
front to back.
Front to back. There we go. I could watch it backwards.
Yeah, I mean, weird. With how much you know Dragon Ball, like, I don't think it would affect the experience that much.
No, it would not. I can pretty much recite the series.
Yeah.
Because I've read the manga many times, so I really know it from that.
Yeah.
So that's the filler is great. It's just, it's surprising. I didn't even know it was fake Namek. Just kidding.
It's like that whole part where Gohan just stumbles onto a town full of orphans that are fighting off people trying to get them out of the town. What an amazing, insightful episode that was.
That has one of my favorite scenes in all of Dragon Ball in it, at the end, where Gohan gets to his mother's house, and he decides not to go in, and Piccolo comes, and instead of judging him or anything, just says, "What is your mission?" He says, "To defeat the Saiyans, protect the Earth." And Piccolo's like, "All right, let's go back."
Which then is really weird when the Saiyans do show up. It's like... Gohan's completely useless for almost the entire fight.
No.
Yes.
He does a lot of stuff.
And only at the end, like, he's the fucking whiny little bitch for the whole thing.
I would argue differently, but that's okay. Anyway, love Dragon Ball. This whole project started in a weird way, where I was trying to catch up on Dragon Ball Super, which is the new series currently airing in Japan.
Yeah.
And then my brother went out of town. Well, he was out of town, and I was talking to him about it. He's like, "Oh, I really want to watch that." I'm like, "Oh, you know what? Why don't I save this, and then we could have that be our, like, summer anime project or something."
Sure, yeah.
Because, like, every summer we kind of watch an anime together. So that could be a fun thing to do. So I'm like, I'll just save that. And it was honestly, because the beginning of Super is a retelling of the recent movies.
Yes.
And it's good. It's just a little hard to get through because I've seen those movies many, especially Battle of Gods. I've seen that, like, 8 times.
Okay, geez.
Just under weird circumstances. I saw it in Japanese when that Blu-ray came out. I saw the English one. I saw the extended cut. I saw it in theaters. And then my brother hadn't seen it. I'm like, okay, let's show this. And he hadn't seen the extended cut. So anyway.
Yeah.
I've seen it a lot of times. It just kind of made me want to go back and watch the stuff I'm nostalgic for.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had my Kai DVDs, and I'm like, maybe I'll just rush through it with some Kai stuff. And I got 2 episodes in, and I'm like, I don't like Kai. I don't like the reanimations. I think it's pretty poorly edited, and some of the replaced voices rubbed me the wrong way. So I'm just like, I don't want to do this. So I'm like, fuck it, I'll make it a project. And I jumped over to the equivalent episode of My Dragon Boxes. And I was actually helpful with Kai, though. I got through the Raditz fight, which I've seen probably upwards of 10 times in the original version.
Yeah. Yeah, the Raditz stuff is not the most interesting.
I really like it. I've just seen it too many times.
I mean, like, even, like, it's just, it feels like it's that weird transitionary period where it's like, you're going from Dragon Ball to Dragon Ball Z, and it's like, the Raditz fight doesn't quite do it for me the way that, like, Nappa and Vegeta show up does.
I got you.
Also, because I just think Raditz is fucking so lame. I hate, like, Raditz is just awful.
No, he is. I love his voice in Japanese. Shigeru Chiba is awesome. I love the trivia that that is also the guy who voiced Pilaf. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I like all of that. It's fine. But anyway, so I started doing that. And I was just kind of... I wasn't even really planning on doing a full rewatch. I just kind of wanted to watch some favorite parts. I just got into it. I've watched 50 episodes in the last week.
Okay.
I've really gotten into it. I'm all the way on box two. So I'm 1/7 through at least. I plowed through Fake Namek last night.
Oh, man.
I did sleep through one of the episodes, and I didn't feel the need to go back and catch up.
Fake Namek stuff's pretty rough. The real, like, soul-searching part is when you hit the Garlic Jr. saga.
Oh, yes.
Do you skip that?
I've never made it through.
When I did my Japanese rewatch, I didn't make it through.
Okay. So I'm going to try.
I tried to. I think I made it 2 episodes in. Okay. I think I made it, like, 1.5 episodes in. I was like... Okay, no, fuck this. Skip it.
Yeah.
Just skip it.
It really tells you how good Toriyama is at what he wrote. When they go so off the book, you're like, that's not even a character design that would show up in Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
One of my favorite shots in all of Dragon Ball Z is the end of the 3rd Fake Namek episode, where they do one of those like shots where it's like a split screen, it shows all the characters in peril, and then the shitty aliens on Fake Namek pop up over it laughing, and they look like, they don't look anything.
Look like they just dropped out of some other shitty anime. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a really shitty anime. It's hilarious. Because no other episode of Dragon Ball even does that, where like the villain comes up at the end laughing over the heroes. It's so stupid. And then they get to Namek and it's really good, so it's fine. Yeah. But I do love that the end of the Fake Namek arc and the beginning of the real Namek arc is one episode. That's always been... I can't believe they did it that way. Mm-hmm. But it's hilarious. So yeah, I'm really enjoying my rewatch, and I've just... certain things have struck me, and why I've been with it is that show is so fucking good.
Yes,
when,
it is, yeah.
When that show is on, it is spine-tingling, it can be heart-wrenching, it can be super funny, it can be all these things... And I just noticed watching the Saiyan arc, which has always been, I don't know if it's my favorite like to watch. I don't know if it's like my favorite in just an overall sense. I do think it is the best, most perfect thing like Toriyama wrote in that series.
Yeah, it's just definitely up there.
If you look at the character arcs and where each character starts and ends and how much happens over the course of things. And just little things that you don't even notice they're doing, but like the friendship between Gohan and Kuririn, just the way that...
Yeah. Naturally develops because those characters have only met like one time before at the very beginning of Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah, and Gohan was too young to even remember.
Yeah.
So they meet, and it's just because they're on the sidelines together, they have
this bond. And they're both about the same height.
Yeah, they're both about the same height. All of that is so great. Obviously the Piccolo stuff, the scene where Piccolo dies, I could definitely say that's my favorite Dragon Ball Z scene. It's up there. It's fantastic. It uses this piece of music that actually originates in Dragon Ball Movie 2, which is the Devil's Castle one.
Oh, and the original Dragon Ball.
Yeah, movie. Sorry, yeah. And the way they transpose that into the Z scene is phenomenal. I love the music in Dragon Ball all over the place. It's so good. And there's just things I've always kind of known, but it didn't hit me until this viewing. Like, Vegeta in the Saiyan arc, the way Ryo Horikawa plays that character is fascinating.
Yeah.
Because he starts not just laid back, it's like he's barely talking. It's like he's at a very low volume. He just talks with sort of this regal authority. And Nappa is the one out... I love Nappa's voice. It's like a Yakuza. He's rolling every single R.
Yeah.
It's great. And Nappa's doing all the fighting. He's doing all the talking. And Vegeta just doesn't give a shit. None of this phases him at all. And then slowly, he starts to get panicked. But even by the time, you know, Goku shows up, he's not really panicked. He's just a little frustrated.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of... In English, it's that famous over 9,000 scene. He's like whispers that in Japanese. Because it's not phasing him yet.
Yeah.
And then... By the time he actually loses his shit, which is in episode 31, which is probably the most famous episode of Dragon Ball Z. It's where Goku uses the Kaioken against him, and then they have their big Kamehameha fight.
Yeah.
It's just an utterly phenomenal episode of anime. And when he loses his shit there, it just like sends you back in your seat because you have not heard this guy lose it like this yet.
Yeah.
But it's not just a one-off yells. He's been building to it over like 20 episodes.
Yeah, where it's just like the slow frustration of his like weird, like arrogant elitism, like clashing against Goku's like, I'm a fucking idiot that doesn't know anything, but I can still kick your ass.
Yes. No, it's all so well done. The reason I love, you know, watching the series more than anything else is the voice acting. It's one of, I think, just the best done series ever in terms of voice acting.
Yeah.
Everyone's so perfectly cast. Everyone just delivers it so well. I love any second Masako Nozawa is voicing Goku. She's just so perfect. But all the characters are. And I realized also one of my things that I think is so dynamic about Dragon Ball Z versus the original Dragon Ball and those kind of two halves of the series, which I love equally in different ways, is that Dragon Ball is very much Goku's story, beginning to end. And if anything, his story kind of climaxes and in some ways wraps up on an arc standpoint with him beating Piccolo Jr. That's kind of his... He wins the Tenkaichi Budokai. He's
achieved which he had been trying to do that like entire series, basically. Yes.
And then past that point, Dragon Ball Z is an ensemble show, through and through. Like, the Namek stuff, Goku is in the background, especially in the series, because he's got some filler on the spaceship.
Yeah.
But that's, like, Kuririn, Gohan, and Vegeta are the main characters there.
Mm-hmm.
And I love what they do with Vegeta in that Namek stuff, where we transition from him being the big bad to being the de facto lead of the show.
Yeah.
But he's not...
But he's not even quite an anti-hero at that point. He's still basically the villain.
Yes. I can't even think of what the equivalent would, that would be. It's such... I love his entire arc through the Namek stuff. It's so fascinating. So, just loving this show. Loving to get to watch my nice DVDs, which I feel very lucky to have because they're out of print and all you can get are their shitty Blu-rays that are cropped and look like they were made in Microsoft Paint. So, don't even know how they got it to that point, but they did.
Yeah.
So, anyway, Dragon Ball Z is a good show, and I'm having fun watching it. And I've even been doing the thing where when the movies come up in the chronology, I've been watching those.
Okay.
So, like,
that's,
on their release
dates. Excessive now.
Oh, but I like some of the movies.
Well, I like some of the movies, too, but they also have nothing to do with, the chronology of Dragon Ball.
But that's what's fun, is because you get... Usually, I just watch them completely divorced, which is probably the best way to do it.
Yeah.
But when you do it this way, like, it's... The movie one isn't that distracting. It's 10 episodes in that came out. But movie 2 comes out right as... It's actually in the middle of the Orphans in Space arc.
Yeah.
So not the Earth Orphans,
where
the space
they redo their own fucking filler story this time in space.
Yes, in the middle of the Space Orphans. And now Piccolo's alive, but he still died for Gohan. But the others are gone. And it's super confusing if you want to think about it that way. And I'm just... Because I'm putting myself in the mindset of Japanese people in the 80s and 90s watching these... Because you could have been watching it every week and then go to the theater and see movie 2 and be like, what's going on?
Well, I think everyone understood that it's like, this has nothing, like, I mean,
no,
it's not, it doesn't have nothing to do with the series, but it's not set strictly within the continuity of the
series. No, absolutely, but it's just a little, when you're into the depth, like the meat of the series, it's jarring to be back like, oh, we haven't seen Piccolo in 20 episodes.
Yeah.
So it's fun.
Well, that's because nobody fucking watched it that way. Like, nobody, like, marathoned a bunch of episodes and then watched the movie. Because that's a stupid fucking way to do it. What is it going to be like when you get to Lord Slug? Like, that's the one to me that's like, where they try to do, like, the fake Super Saiyan bullshit.
Yeah.
That's where it's, like, really...
That one's pretty bad.
It's a bad movie, and it's just weird. It's their version of, like, trying to interpret things that haven't happened yet, like Super Saiyan, is very bizarre.
But the first movie, Dead Zone, I love the shit out of that movie. Always have. It's one of my favorites.
The early Dragon Ball Z movies, I think, are actually pretty good. Like, out of those
sets. I tend to like
sets.
The later ones more, but I do love movie one, yeah.
I think there's something about, like, it's very refreshing to go back to something where, like, Super Saiyan is not the solution.
No, I
Spear Bomb is not the solution to every single problem.
No, I totally understand. Movie two is weird, that the world's strongest one, because... The last half hour of that movie is literally just episode 31 of DBZ, the one I was just talking about, where Goku has to use the Kaioken. He goes times 3. It's not enough. He uses the Kamehameha. The other guy's got a blast. He has to go times 4. Like, they even reuse some animation.
Yeah, but in that case, he's doing it all against a giant brain in a massive robot suit.
It's fun. I'm not denying that.
I think that qualifies as a significant enough difference to make it awesome.
And I am excited to get to movie 3, because that's where we get the first time Masako Nozawa plays like a male villain Saiyan, and it's weird.
Yeah, like, it tells you a lot about the Dragon Ball Z movies that by movie number 3, they already used evil Goku.
Yes.
Like, they already went there by the third movie out of, like, how many are there?
There are 13.
13, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm trying to rewatch everything I have. And that's the other thing that's jarring, though, is because those movies have not come out in their Dragon Box version. So I go from this pristine, wonderful Dragon Box footage to the old Funimation DVDs.
Yeah.
And it's not Funimation's fault at all. That's the masters they were given because Toei are really stingy with their masters.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh, God, that Goku's suit is like neon orange. That's not right. It's like glowing. I don't get it. Anyway, so I've been having fun. Dragon Ball Z is really good.
Yes, it is.
But I've been talking for a long time. I've been doing things that have been making me happy. That's nice.
Yeah.
I don't know. What have you been up to, Sean?
I mean, things relevant for this podcast. I finished The Witcher 3 Blood and Wine. And I've been going through like a weird, like video games very rarely do this to me, but every once in a while a really good one, like Persona 3, Persona 4 obviously had this effect, where it's like that when you've been reading a like long, great series of novels or something, and you finally get to the end of it, and you're like, oh, fuck. Like, now, like, I have to, like, leave these characters in this setting, in this world, and it's like, like, knowing that this is the last piece of content for The Witcher 3, and The Witcher 3 is likely the last Witcher game to be made. I mean, I guess CD Projekt Red could make more if they wanted to, but I think they've basically said that they don't see that, you know.
Right, and I've seen interviews where they've kind of gone back and forth. They say they are 100% done with Geralt, but they might do more just in The Witcher universe.
Which would be fine, I guess, but, like, I love Geralt so much as a character, especially after... Now, because, you know, in between playing Hearts of Stone and Blood and Wine, I read all the novels that have been released in English, which is basically all of them except for the last one now. And so, like, I did such a deep dive on The Witcher over the past, like, year of my life, basically, because The Witcher came out in, like, early May of 2015. So it's, like, been a little bit over a year by the time I finished Blood and Wine, so it's, like, putting that down and, like... The moment that they end, like, the last story mission, like, the sort of the note they leave it on is so perfect and elegant that it was like, oh, fuck. It was like, it was just everything hit me all of a sudden where it's like, oh, no, like, this is the last, like, I mean, obviously the last book is going to come out, but it was like, I have to, like, leave this stuff and, like, I can't get more new stuff of it because the Blood and Wine overall is just amazing. Like they... nail it across the board because by the last time I talked about it, I hadn't gotten that deep into the main quest line. I had mostly been doing the open world side of it and all the side quests and stuff, and all that stuff is excellent, and it is kind of the bulk of the content for Blood and Wine, whereas for Hearts of Stone, that is very much, that piece of DLC is about the sort of the main quest and this long main quest line, and there's some extra side stuff they put in, but like that side of it is very slim. This is like a whole new region just full of new side quests, new characters, new little storylines to pursue, and all that stuff is fantastic. And then the main storyline is probably not even quite as long as actually as Hearts of Stone is, but it is such a perfectly told story. The new characters they have in there, or some of them characters like Regis the Vampire, who is a character from the books, it's one of my favorites that they bring back for this. Like, that stuff is so perfect. They have a character called the Duchess, Anna Henrietta, who's the Duchessa of Toussaint. She is a fantastic character, like, just such a perfectly fully realized character that is almost like kind of the story of Blood and Wine is almost more her story than it is Geralt's, which is how a lot of the storytelling in The Witcher tends to go, is they focus on a new character introduced in the region or, like, related to whatever the monster quest is, and you really get into her past and her family and her relationships with members of her family, and like how this like intertwines with this vampire threat that is sort of the monster you have to deal with. All that stuff is so perfect. And then also, when I got to the end of Blood and Wine, I actually like played kind of the last mission twice to see the two different, there's three different endings, but like there's really mostly two different endings that you can get to Blood and Wine, and both of them are like, somehow they are like polar opposites, and yet they are both equally perfect endings to the story that they tell, which I just fundamentally don't understand how that works, because most games that have like the multiple ending stuff, it usually is like when I finished The Walking Dead season 1 and there's two endings to that, like I picked one ending not really realizing that that choice I made was going to be the last choice you make in the story, and like that choice led to what I felt was like, oh, this is a shitty ending. Like, this is not, if I had known that this was the last thing, I would have picked the other one because the other one is better. But I wasn't thinking about it in that context, because it's like the choice at the end of Walking Dead season 1 is like one ending, or one of them is like a pretty elegant, well-written note to leave that story on. The other one's just kind of dumb and doesn't make sense as a way to end that story. In Blood and Wine, you have two endings that are like completely different, and yet they are both just pitch fucking perfect. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. Blood and Wine is really, really good, if you didn't get that from my rant just there.
Yeah, I can't wait to play it. I kind of want... I don't know. I'm not in the Witcher mindset at the moment, but I can't wait to get into it, and definitely going to play that before the end of the year, because I think it'll probably be a fixture on both our top tens.
Yeah. And I'm going to have a hard time figuring out what to do, because it's like, it feels like it's so unfair to put it up too high, like put it above other stuff like Uncharted 4, even though I think I probably had a better time with Blood and Wine than I did with Uncharted 4.
And it's tough because Blood and Wine is the kind of last big ending point to a game that was this mammoth masterpiece that we've already had a year of experience with. They're so hard to compare. We'll have to see. Maybe next year we'll have Uncharted 4 DLC and then we can have the whole conversation again.
Yeah, who knows.
Uncharted 4, Blood and Wine.
Yeah, where Nathan Drake has to fight a vampire and he travels to the fairy tale-like land of Toussaint.
Maybe that's what they have to do with the Uncharted 4 DLC, is like go Far Cry Blood Dragon on us and do something crazy with Nathan Drake.
I would be totally into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway. So then other than The Witcher 3 Blood and Wine, which if you are someone who has played through The Witcher stuff, you have already played through Blood and Wine. It's like, if you are that deep into it, if like you are someone who made it like all the way through like the 100-hour RPG that is The Witcher 3, you are probably like in the market for more of that kind of stuff.
Of course.
But other than that, I also finally like have had time to dip into some of the games in my backlog that I've been really waiting to get to, because this early part of the year, where usually this sort of the first half of the year is where no new video games come out that are like that remarkable, or there's like one every other month or so. And then so I usually get a lot of time to be like, oh, I finally get to play some of the games I missed last year or like a couple of years ago. This year has not been like that at all. Like, no. I have been playing new releases basically since Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth came out in like February. So I finally had time to go back and play some old stuff. And so the first thing I've dipped into is Gravity Rush, the remastered version on PS4, which you talked about like a month or so ago. And I basically agree with everything you said then. Like, it is a great game. There are a couple of things about the controls that, like, could be tightened up and stuff like that. But those are, like, relatively minor complaints in the scope of just, like, the unbelievable art style. Like, and the animation within that art style is so just immaculate and perfect and executes such a distinctive vision for how that game looks that borrows influences both from, like, obviously, like, Japanese manga styles, but then also a lot of, like, Western European comic book style. Like, Mobius, who's a very famous French comic book artist, is a clear influence on it. The music is amazing. Like, and just moving around the world and existing in that world is so sort of intoxicating and relaxing. And the characters are so awesome. Like, I love Kat, the main character you play as.
She's wonderful.
They do so much with characterizing her. I love to death the comic book, like, graphic novel cutscene stuff they do. That is the best I've ever seen that conceit be done. And, like, it's been done very well in some other games, like Peace Walker. But here, like, even though, like you know, Gravity Rush 2 obviously has a bigger budget and has had a lot more development time and stuff like that. And so it's like they could go full, like, normal 3D model cutscenes. I hope they stick with the comic book stuff, because I think it's, like, that's just so awesome. And then, basically, like, I was looking at the trophies last night. I'm 4 missions away from the very end of the game. I'm basically like right near the cusp of the end. And I was just going around and wrapping up a bunch of challenges and stuff. And so the only trophies I have left to get in the game are the last few story missions. So I've basically done almost everything you can do other than actually finish the goddamn game.
That's exactly the way I played it. I have platinumed that game and I got all the trophies for both of the DLC sets. So I have every trophy you can possibly get in that. And it wasn't because I felt like I had to do it. It's because I wanted to do it. And I just naturally, as you say, the world is so fun to exist in. Like, that is a very small open world. But that's how you do a good open world. Where you just want to be in it and explore it and have fun inside it. And the art style is so good. The comic book. Like, the thing is, those comic panels. And in the remastered, you can go in from the menu and view all of them alone.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. It's like, they're so well. They look like you could print them out and they would be a comic book.
Yeah.
Which, like, I like the Peace Walker stuff. But it's much more just, we're doing this as a shorthand, you know?
Sure.
And this is, like, fully fleshed out. And it just, even though there is some control wonkiness, I think, going from Vita to PS4. Overall, it feels like this always should have been on the PS4.
Yeah.
It does not make sense as a Vita game.
Yeah. And, like, the control wonkiness more comes from the fact that, like, what the primary mechanic of the gravity shifting in the game is something that, like playing with gravity is something that plenty of games have done. But I've never seen something, like, commit to that idea so thoroughly as, like, an ingrained mechanic in the game. Yeah. And, like, what they do with, like, the combat and the movement in the game is, like, something that like, is not... It's an untrodden path in video games. Like, nobody has made a game that controls like that. And then there's something about, like, all of Gravity Rush, both in the art style, like, the aesthetic quality of it, and that sort of, we're just going to, like, do our own weird thing with the controls and, like, this mechanic and everything. And it's, like, it's sort of a game that's like, I feel like it's kind of impossible to qualify the genre of it, because it's like, it's not really a platformer, though it shares a lot of qualities with 3D platformers. It's like, it's certainly not like a character action game, but the combat stuff is way more involved than a platformer normally would have, and so that has almost a quality of like a 3D action game. Like, it's just blends so much together, and it reminds me of like that heyday of like Sega Dreamcast games.
Yes.
Of like stuff like Jet Set Radio, that's like, fuck it, man. Like, we're just going to make this weird, crazy thing that, like, nobody has made a game that looks like this, that plays like this. And it's like, it's going to be wonky. It's going to be, like, sort of, like, unpolished in different ways. Because you're not working off of this sort of, like, building off of the mechanics that have been well-trodden in the past. It's not a first-person shooter. It's not a third-person cover shooter. It's not a JRPG. It's not, like, a side-scroller platformer. It is its own unique game. And so I feel, like, perfectly happy, like, acknowledging, you know, yeah, like, some of that combat stuff could be smoother. Like, every once in a while, the camera in general is fantastic, given how complex of what yes. the camera needs to do is. But it does, every once in a while, like, really disorientate the player in a way that does not feel intentional and stuff like that. But that's fine, like, because if you don't have that, you don't get the rest of what is fantastic about the game.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so you're now on board with me and other people being really excited for Gravity Rush
2? Oh, yeah, I am super stoked about Gravity Rush 2, and just, like, I have been going back and I rewatched a couple of the trailers and stuff. Now they have more context for them, and yeah, like, that game looks like it's going to be awesome. Because if, that, like, Gravity Rush is a game that demands a sequel, because what it needs is that, like, iterative process to really refine everything, because yeah. it has that sort of very bohemian style to it.
And while I love the story really is like a tour through this world and an
yeah,
intro
it's
the world.
Slight.
Yeah, but it's and it, but it feels like that's intentional. Like, this is our first step. It's going to introduce you into all the steps in this world, and then maybe next time we could go more in depth in one of these areas.
Yeah,
which it seems like that's what they're doing. Like, the next game is going to have a lot more of Kat and her the woman who kind of becomes her sidekick.
Raven.
Yeah. So I'm very excited about all of that. It's and the music in that game is great.
Music's great. There's so many, like, unbelievable little details they have. Like, I love it's that kind of game where it has its own sort of fake language and stuff to it. But the best part of that is with the comic book aesthetic, they commit to having fake language sound effects written in, like, manga style, because there's sound effects all over the place written into the art, but it's all in their fake, like, alphabet. Like, that is fucking amazing that they went that far with it. And, like, I love all the not even just, like, the comic book cutscenes, but even when you just have the conversation with the characters and the portraits come up, the art in those is unbelievable. Like, it's just so expressive, where it's, like, usually that's, like, a very common sort of choice for Japanese games, because then you don't have to do, you know, a lot of, like, animating 3D models and stuff like that, which is expensive and time-consuming. But a lot of the time, that just sort of looks like more of a cost-saving measure. Here, like, the portrait art is so beautiful that I'm really happy, like, every time one of those exchanges comes up, because it's like, I just want to see, like, this different character's, like, all their different expressions in that portrait, because it's so, like, unique and different-looking, you know?
Absolutely. This is a game I hope never gets voice acting. Yeah. And overrides what's so special.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if, like, it has more voice acting, it should all just be in their weird fake, like, French-sounding language.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, that game is one of the best games on the PS4. I think if you have a PS4, it's a must-own.
Yeah, I think it's a game that people should play, because it is so unique and so different, and then yeah. it executes what it tries to execute so well.
Absolutely. So, anything else?
No, that's about it.
All right, let's move on to a couple quick pieces of news.
Okay.
I got these on my outline. First one is sad. So, we have to go through this. Anton Yelchin,
right,
who
yeah.
You will probably know best as the actor who has been playing Scotty. No, not Scotty.
Chekhov.
I'm sorry. Chekhov in the new Star Trek movies.
Yeah.
Died this last week. 27. Freak automobile accident. Sad for so many reasons. He was a great actor. If you only knew yeah. him from the Star Trek movies, then you saw someone who was committed and enthusiastic and soulful, and that's wonderful. But if you have not seen any of the Sundance indie dramas, for instance, he was a terrific young actor. There's a movie called, now I'm blanking on the name, Like Crazy is what it's called. It's called Like Crazy. You should also watch this because it was kind of the debut of Felicity Jones, who's the star of the new Star Wars movie. But they play he and Felicity Jones play a young couple who kind of fall in love. They get married even though she's from England and she's in the U.S. on a visa. And she winds up overstaying her visa because they're in love and kind of what comes from that. I don't think it's a perfect movie, but it is incredibly acted. And the two of them together, they're very good. And he did a lot of movies kind of like that, that were just smaller and more intimate, and he was very good at that. And he had so much promise as an actor, and there were so many things I was excited and hoping to see him in, because I just think he was one of those names of, like, this generation of actors you throw out there, you know, almost like with Jennifer Lawrence or someone, where you're like, this is a really good actor of that age range. I'm so excited to see what they do. And, of course, when anyone dies, it's sad when someone dies that young and with that much promise. Absolute tragedy. So, just wanted to mention that.
It's awful.
And, you know, with Star Trek Beyond coming out next month, it kind of feels even more raw. And can't imagine what all those people in the cast and his friends and family and everything must be going through. I look forward to seeing his last performance as Chekhov. I thought he did a really good job in that role. I'm curious to see what they do going forward with that character. But yeah, so just wanted to mention that because it's sad. So we can move on to something else. Other piece of news was this week, because Warner Brothers is very flop sweaty about their DC plans.
Yes, they are.
They invited journalists a couple weeks ago to the set of the Justice League movie currently in production, directed by Zack Snyder, and showed them some footage and some shooting. And so set reports came out for Justice League. Now, it is not unusual for reporters to be invited to the set for a movie. It is absolutely unusual for those set reports to go up a year and a half in advance of the movie's release.
Yeah.
While the movie is still in principal photography.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever heard of that.
I don't think I have either.
Yeah. So the tone of the set reports was all were all very similar. Clearly, Zack and Deborah Snyder were on fucking message, and their message was, don't worry, we included jokes.
Like,
I mean, did you read these reports, Sean?
I kind of glanced at them. Like, there's only so much Zack Snyder I can take anymore in my life, where I feel like he has just descended to this point where it's like, I just can't stand, I can't even just stand reading his words, because like, because some of like the interviews I have read, like, are so, the transcriptions of them are so amazing, because like his sort of weird meandering, has no idea what the fuck he's talking about way of speech, like, comes across so thoroughly in the transcription, where there's just like 500 hyphens just interrupting the middle of his own sentences.
He's like the Donald Trump of filmmaking.
It has that kind of quality to it. Yes,
not that he says anything as bad as Donald Trump. I'm not trying to say that.
Like, I mean, that would be pretty extraordinary if he did. But he's he has that manner of like, he can't quite just like fully express a single thought, and so he just keeps on interrupting what he's saying. It's like he just ends up saying nothing by the end of like this fucking paragraph.
That's like every movie of his too.
Yeah,
he says a lot, but he doesn't know what he's saying.
Yeah.
That is the definition of Batman v Superman.
Yes,
that movie says an awful lot without saying anything.
Yeah.
Anyway,
the movie's long.
No, but the Justice League set reports, basically what they were shown is they were shown one scene on the roof of a Gotham building. So you had J.K. Simmons as Commissioner Gordon.
Okay.
Apparently he got ripped for that. Have you
seen that? Yeah, I've sort of like a minor meme that happened with like,
because he looks like Muten Roshi from Dragon Ball.
Yeah, exactly. He has that quality of like old, like someone that old should not be that insanely ripped. Like,
also, why does Gordon need to be ripped?
I mean, he is like an army veteran, so I guess like there's that quality to him. But he also
just
like,
it just makes me think of Zack Snyder's body fetishizing. Yeah, though.
I mean, that might be an element of it. Yes.
Yeah. Anyway,
I can see an argument for why Gordon would be very physically built, but I don't think he would need to be that built.
No, I gotcha. But anyway, so they're on the roof with Gordon, and they talk about something, and most of the Justice League is there, I guess. Except Superman, of course, because he's dead.
Except for he's not dead. That was the best part about the interviews I saw, was everyone asking, so I was like, is Superman, like, where's Superman in this? And, like, Zack Snyder, like, trying to say, like, Superman's obviously in this movie, but I can't just say that because we killed him at the end of our last movie. Like, fucking idiots.
I just think it's funny because, again, we're starting the Justice League movie with Superman dead.
Yeah.
It's like starting the Avengers movie with Tony Stark, like, in prison or something.
Yeah.
You just can't,
like,
do it.
You just, like, have this massive narrative hurdle you have to get through before you can actually make the Justice League. It's like, now you just, like, made this huge fucking problem for yourself with that.
Yes. So anyway, they're on the roof and everyone leaves, and then the Flash is still there, and he's like, they do that to you? Oh, that's mean. And all I'm thinking is, that's the best joke you have?
Yeah.
It's okay, but Chris Nolan made that joke like 5 times in his Dark Knight movies.
Yeah.
And everyone makes that joke about Batman, so whatever. People did say they liked Ezra Miller as the Flash. Don't doubt it. He could totally be good. But we'll see. Again, I say I'm going to have trouble because I do watch the Flash TV show every week, and I like that character, and I don't know if I have room in my life for 2 Flashes, but we will see. So there was that. I guess there was another scene or something, and then they talked a lot about it. They confirmed Lex Luthor is going to be in the movie in some capacity.
Yeah.
The best thing, I think, was they confirmed the identity of the villain. And it's...
Oh, yeah.
It's Steppenwolf. It's
Steppenwolf.
Who the fuck is Steppenwolf?
He's, like, a minor fucking, like, fourth world character. Like he's, like, a dark side apocalypse minion thing. It's like...
Yeah.
I barely know who Steppenwolf is. Like, it's... Yeah, like... That's so sad when, like, you announce the villain for your Justice League movie and, like, someone who's a, like, pretty nerdy comic book guy like myself, like, looks at that and is like, why would you, like, okay, like, why would you pick fucking Steppenwolf? Like, who gives a shit?
Like, I'm not saying the villain of a comic book movie needs to be recognizable to everyone.
No.
But when he's not recognizable to comic book readers,
yeah,
then you're maybe in trouble. Like... Again, I don't want to compare everything to Marvel, but since they're the ones doing it right and not stepping over their own shoelaces, it's like, you know, Loki being the villain of Avengers 1, okay, we can all be on board with that.
Yeah.
No Loki. Ultron is number as the second movie. Okay, most people probably don't know who Ultron is, but he's a pretty big comic villain.
But yeah. I know.
Yeah. And it's and you get your fucking James Spader and it's cool. They still have not cast Steppenwolf. He's in the movie, but they haven't cast him yet, so he's probably going to be CGI or something, is what they're saying.
I think there's, like, if I remember correctly, like, there was a weird deleted scene thing from Batman v Superman that people, that came out a little bit after that movie was released, that people were like, oh, there's this thing where Lex Luthor's in, like, the ship, and he's interacting with some sort of, like,
I watched that scene.
Guy.
He's not interacting with anything. He's interacting with thin air. And
oh, yeah, I mean, it's a big CG bullshit thing.
No, there's no CGI. Did you see the scene?
I think I did, yeah.
I don't think there's anything there. I think there's a voice and, like, a shadow. But, like,
maybe there was like, some concept art that came out also.
What I remember was everyone was saying, here's a list of who it could be, and then someone involved in the movie said it's supposed to be Steppenwolf. The scene in no way confirmed anything.
Yeah, but, like, yeah, because it was something where... I mean, I definitely saw the visual design vaguely of whatever it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
It was like, it doesn't look like Steppenwolf, because Steppenwolf is, like, a dude. It's, like, a big, weird monster-looking thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, like,
it's so obvious that these movies are being made by a bunch of people who have never picked up a DC comic in their life and are trying to kind of figure it out. And I can just see the writer of these movies, Chris Terrio, who is a good writer, but he's a writer of movies like Argo, like historical fiction, not Batman. And I can just see him at his desk, like, Wikipediaing just different DC things and being like, I like the name Steppenwolf, let's do that.
Yeah.
Because we're not going to do Darkseid right now because we're scared because we fucked it up so much last time.
Yeah.
Because clearly that's where they were going with it.
I mean, if they were going to do, like, another, like, Darkseid adjacent villain, they should have just used Granny Goodness because she's awesome. And then you could get Mr. Miracle in there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Those are two characters the people making these movies have never heard of.
Probably not, but they are legitimately... Granny Goodness is a fucking great villain. Like, I love her to death. She's, like, she has some couple of episodes in the Justice League cartoon that are pretty great.
Anyway, just these set reports annoyed me for a couple of reasons. In part was the tone. Like, I don't... Obviously, you have to be objective as a journalist. I get that. I don't want people to be objective and forget that we got a really shitty movie last time.
Yeah, and like pretend, a really shitty movie.
And pretend that, A, that's just okay that they can do that and release a movie where Batman is spouting fascist rhetoric.
Yeah.
And that you can just... Even if they made, like, a super fun, happy Justice League movie... I'm not going to forget that I saw Ben Affleck murder people with his bare hands last
exactly,
time.
Yeah, like...
And I don't think you can actually turn that around. And also, all of this happened on set while they're shooting. They went in with a script that was probably written around the same time as Batman v Superman. They started shooting this before Batman v Superman came out, or at least they started pre-production and everything. I think it started shooting in April. That movie was March. All of these adjustments would have to be happening on the fly. You know, so, and that's not how you make a good movie.
No, yeah. And then he also, like, I don't think Zack Snyder's capable of making those adjustments even if he's told to and is trying to, you know? Like, that's not a part of his style. That's not what he does. I was going to say that's not what he's good at. He's not good at much anymore. But, like, I don't think he can do that. I don't think he can make... Like, physically, I don't think he's capable of making the Justice League movie that people kind of want to be made.
No, I mean, obviously, when he's a filmmaker who has gone all in on super grimdark bullshit twice in a row, defended it twice in a row, and is now saying, oh, we're going to throw in some jokes, you're doing that out of a reaction, not because you organically understand your own mistakes, obviously. Yeah. Because you're doing that, because that was also the tone of all these interviews is clearly people like Ben Affleck wanted to say, we fucked up really bad and we're trying to fix it, but they yeah. can't say that. So they're like, that one, you know, it had to be really dark because it was these two meeting for the first time. And like the gymnastics they have to do to justify Batman v Superman, but also explain why they want to change everything.
Yeah.
Well, you only want to change everything if you thought it didn't work last time, right?
Yeah.
So it's just all super flop sweaty. I think it doesn't instill any confidence because, frankly, if you had your eyes open and you realized Batman v Superman was terrible, you know it's terrible. And if yeah. you're one of those DC fans who drank the Kool-Aid and just is going to love it no matter what, yeah. even though you're describing a movie that does not exist, you're going to love this no matter what. So whatever. Yeah. And yeah, that movie's not going to do well, I don't think.
I don't think so either. Like, it's... Man, like, the way that, like, Batman v Superman just, like, dropped off at the box office was kind of incredible to see.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So anyway, was there any post-E3 news worth talking about?
Not really. Like, there's, like, obviously there's lots of small stuff, of, yeah. like, other trailers for games and stuff like that, but I don't think there was anything major that came out that yeah. we need to address.
I agree. So why don't we do one of our topics?
Okay.
Let's talk about the Nintendo 64 first.
Let's talk about the N64.
Yes, it came out 20 years ago in Japan this week.
Yep.
Pretty cool. 20 years old. The Nintendo 64, I have so many things I could say about it. Its place in history is undeniable just for the number of, you know, games that are absolutely historically important and yeah. game-changing in every way under the sun. But for me, it was my first console I ever owned. I had a Game Boy, I think, before that. I had a Game Boy Color. But in terms of home consoles, this was the first one I owned. We got it, and the first two games I got were Super Smash Brothers.
Yeah.
Obviously.
It's a good one.
And the Let's Get Ready to Rumble wrestling game was the other one.
Okay, I had a wrestling game on my N64 as well. That was because my brother bought it, but...
Yeah, no, it wasn't... I mean, my parents just, I think, picked it up at the store and got it.
Sure, yeah.
My N64, I think they got it used because one of the, like, ports is kind of broken, but it still works, and it's still cooking. My brother and I play the N64 every once in a while still.
Yeah.
Works just fine. That is a sturdy little console. But yeah, and I encountered the N64 before because of Super Smash Brothers. I would play it at friends' houses. That's really why my brother and I wanted it. And I think that is my prime, even though in retrospect, historically, the two most important games on the N64 are Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time,
yes,
which yeah. are single player only games. That is in my memory defined as a multiplayer console because it was the first console with four ports.
Yeah.
It had these four player multiplayer games. It had Smash Bros, which is the template for one of my all time favorite games. It had things like the Mario Party games. It had Mario 64. It had lots of other good little multiplayer games. You know, Mickey's Speedway USA. I'm just kidding. That's not a
sure,
good game.
Sure.
I had that.
Didn't play that, but...
No, it's not very good.
You can like it if you want, Jonathan. It's okay.
I still have it. I popped it in the other day with my brother. We were joking around. I'm like, what? We still have this? And it's not good.
I wouldn't think
it's,
so.
It's one of the mini Mario Kart 64 clones that came out on the 64.
Yeah, that was when, like, kart racing was still a genre.
Yeah.
You know?
Other than it's just Mario Kart.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, carrying that torch. But yeah, so I that's where I always have to start with the N64, is we had, you know, three or four controllers, and we would play a lot of multiplayer. My brother and I still go back to original Smash Bros. Sometimes, because even though it's, you know, the later Smash Bros. Games added a lot of things that make it more fun and easier to play, there's like a charm to that original Smash Bros. That I
yeah,
love.
There's something about, like, every character being made out of, like, five polygons, and, like, the insanely slow and, like, floaty movement in Super yeah. Smash Bros. 1.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely has a charm to it.
Yep, no, I love the N64 to death. It's the system that really got me into playing video games, despite having, like, the worst controller ever.
Yes, like, at least it is the worst controller for any console that succeeded.
Yes.
Like, that's just, man, the N64 controller is a hot fucking piece of garbage.
It's amazing that so many truly revolutionary games were made with that controller.
Yeah, no, I mean, but it feels like they had to make them, like, very much in spite of the controller, because, like... Just why would you ever make a controller that, like, has a whole section of the controller where no matter how you hold it, you just cannot reasonably access? It's like the N64, it's like you either are on the control stick, and thus you can easily hit the Z trigger, or you're on the D-pad, in which case now you can hit L. It's like...
You can't do both.
You can't do both. You can't use both the D-pad and the control stick unless you're, like, doing some weird voodoo with, like, you're really stretching your hand across, and even then you can't do that for long.
Yeah.
It's a bad controller.
Oh, it's a very bad controller.
It's a very, very bad controller.
And yet, it really is interesting, as you say, how certain games made use of it. I think if you look at both Mario 64 and Zelda, they are so inspired by the limitations of that controller and have stood the test of time despite that and changed the industry despite... It's almost like we had to have that bad controller to get the greatness and then figure out controllers past that point.
Yeah, man.
Because it wasn't a time, you know, that came out around the same time as the PlayStation 1.
Yes.
And PlayStation 1 literally had its 20th anniversary like last year or the year before or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And because they did all those big celebrations and stuff. And, you know, when it came out, that was just a D-pad and buttons. And then later they added the two control sticks. So the two control stick thing was not obvious to people at first.
Yeah.
And the N64 just had the one. And that is not inherently the problem, although that control stick is garbage the way
it looks. Oh, it's so bad.
It's
man.
I mean, literally... Mario Party 1, the first Mario Party, had mini games that seemed pretty innocuous. You just have to spin the controller, but it would break it off, and they lost tens of millions in lawsuits because
of that. And then also, like, the top of the control stick is just hard, like, ribbed plastic. Like, if someone's just was, like, sadistic at Nintendo and was just like, I'm just gonna put, like, plastic knives on the top of this fucking control stick. Because in Mario Party 1, there was a mini game. I remember this because they had an N64 at what was basically kind of like a like daycare kind of thing at my elementary school, where like you could drop your kids off there like an hour early or something for like parents that had like work early or something like that. So you could drop the kids off and they would basically go to the cafeteria and they had a bunch of games and stuff. And they had an N64 and they had a Mario Party 1 there, which is the only way I ever played Mario Party 1. And there's one mini game where you're on a raft, and it's like a 3v1 mini game, and you have to rotate the control stick really quickly to like try to fight the other players. And it was like you would have bruises on your hand. Like literally, Nintendo had to send out like make available for free like little like weird like cloth gloves that they just like manufactured wholesale to send, because it was a controversy, because kids were like bleeding out of the palms of their hands by just playing this game, like, normally. Like, you just, it's like, it's not like you have to be a crazy person to play that game and hurt yourself. It's like, the, like, natural way to play that mini game, because it's competitive, is to try to do it as hard as you can. And it's like, that is bad for you.
I mean, you gotta, like, if you want a comparison, if maybe you're a little younger, think of the Wii controversy where people would throw their Wiimotes. And so they eventually gave the little, like, the gloves for the Wiimotes and made sure the wrist straps were more. And that was an inconvenience for Nintendo. This was a way bigger controversy.
Yeah, because it went so far that I think I recall correctly that, like, they deliberately made it so that, like, the gloves that they sent out had no, like, Nintendo branding on them at all. Because it's like, you don't want these gloves. Like, they're not, like, it's not like a Nintendo item, you know. It's not like, hey, they're cool, like, the single Mario Party glove you get. It's like, no, this is like a necessity because we really fucked up. And it's really weird that out of like of the video game manufacturers, like the big video game companies like Sony and Microsoft and Nintendo and Sega and everyone, it is Nintendo, the kid-focused one, that this fucking keeps happening to. Because you're right, it is very similar to what happened when the Wii came out and people fucking broke their goddamn televisions or, like, their noses and, like, just, like, throwing Wiimotes all over the goddamn place. It's like, how is it that the child-focused one is the one that is causing everyone, like, extreme, like, property damage and pain?
All right, so those are some of the downsides of the N64.
Yeah.
The upsides were many, though.
It's a console that I have sort of like sophisticated, like complicated feelings on it now.
Yeah.
Because I think when you look back at it historically, I think the N64 was the inflection point for Nintendo where they started kind of slipping.
I agree.
Because, I mean, it is the one. I mean, that is the generation where they lost to Sony and Nintendo never got it back.
No, I mean, if we look historically, just a brief bit of history. During the SNES days, they were looking at developing a CD project with Sony.
Yes.
That, for Nintendo, eventually became the Philips CDI, which is not good.
Yeah.
And for Sony, became the PlayStation. Sony won in that one.
Yes,
and,
they did.
So Sony had the PlayStation, Nintendo had the N64, and they decided to stick with cartridges. And, you know, you can see both sides of this argument. Because the original PlayStation is very cumbersome with some of its discs. The loading times.
Yeah, the loading times on the PlayStation 1 are ridiculous.
And some of the ways discs could scratch, and the way piracy worked, all of that was a problem. The upshot, though, is it's easier to make. and you had more room and you could do more with it. With cartridges, you couldn't pirate and they were harder to break, and that's all good. And so you kind of understand why Nintendo stuck with it.
Yeah, and they load instantly. They load instantly. That's how cartridge memory works.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And so that's a real upside of the N64. But the problem was, if you were like Square Enix and you wanted to make a game like Final Fantasy VII, you literally couldn't realize that vision on the N64, and that's where things start to slip.
Yeah, because Final Fantasy before that was a Nintendo basically exclusive franchise.
Yes.
Like, exclusives are kind of like a weird thing in the Nintendo Sega era, because those consoles were more like different. But like, it was like Final Fantasy was only on Nintendo consoles, it was only on the NES and the Super Nintendo, and then when the PlayStation 1 and N64 generation happened, Final Fantasy VII jumped ship to be a PlayStation 1 exclusive because you couldn't make it on the N64. Because Final Fantasy VII was a multi-disc game, and you could make multi-disc games. You cannot really make multi-cartridge games unless, well, we'll talk about a multi-cartridge game when we start talking about Sonic the Hedgehog. But with, like, one extreme and really amazing exception, you cannot make a multi-cartridge game. It would have been amazing if they had Final Fantasy VII on like 8 carts that you just like stacked on top of each other coming out of the N64.
I mean, you would have to do some kind of cumbersome password system. Yeah. That's the only way that can work, and it's not ideal.
Yeah, and like the other like things with like cartridges is that cartridges have like in like onboard memory. That's kind of how they work, and so. And this was like, it's true of like Sega Genesis games, NES games, Super Nintendo games. Different cartridges could be more expensive than other cartridges, depending on how much was actually physically in them. So like, because like, I mean, like an NES example is like Legend of Zelda was more expensive because it had a bit like battery memory in there. Right. Whereas like other cartridges would not have that. So no, that creates like a weird consumer thing where it's like you're not sure what like the price of goods are. Like, you don't have the sort of like standardized market that CDs created, because CDs are cheap to manufacture, and the way that they work with like loading memory into RAM, it just like makes it so you can make more complex like memory intensive games like a Final Fantasy VII.
I absolutely think that's an important thing to point out, because I remember when I was a kid and we had our N64, we pretty much only bought games used, like from Blockbuster or something, or we rented games. Because buying them new, they were very expensive, more so than anything on the PlayStation. And as you say, the price fluctuated. The one I remember is Pokemon Stadium 2 was, I think, a $70 game.
Yeah.
Like, base price. And it was everyone was like, why does it cost that much? It's probably because it had more stuff going on
inside. Yeah, like, it was a more expensive cartridge to manufacture than other cartridges.
No, but this, it is, the N64, I think, is one of the most fascinating moments, not just in Nintendo history, but video game history. Because if you look at the kind of battle between the N64 and the PlayStation, the PlayStation has a wider range of great games. If you look at the innovation on the PlayStation, you have things like Metal Gear Solid and Final Fantasy VII and games like that that were absolutely revolutionary, but also none of those feel as fully realized as the great games on the N64.
Yeah.
The Ocarina of Time and Super Mario 64, I think we can probably agree, are the two greatest games of that generation.
Basically, yeah.
Two of the greatest games ever made. They have stood the test of time beautifully.
Yeah.
And nothing, I think, on the PlayStation has quite stood that same test of time. And yet, you could argue that, okay, so the decisions Nintendo made at that time allowed for two of the greatest games ever made, and so it's hard to be mad about that. But those decisions also led to a sort of downfall for Nintendo from the place they had during the NES and Super NES era.
Yeah.
It's a very weird dichotomy that came during that period of video game history.
Yeah, because, like, Nintendo also, like, I mean, that's where they started losing the third parties, because most of the third parties were, like, making games for the PlayStation. Because that was also, again, like, now, it's very different now, because for a long time now, basically, since, like, the Xbox PlayStation 2 era, consoles have been fairly standardized. Like, they're more or less equivalent in a lot of ways, even, like, with the PS3 and the Xbox 360, a lot of the stuff of the architecture of the PS3 was very different. But, like, the fundamentals of, like, these are both game consoles that run games off of motherfucking discs, that was the same, you know? When you have two consoles like the PlayStation and the N64, like, the controllers are completely different. Like, they have just straight up different numbers of buttons. It's like, you cannot just translate a game on the N64 to the PlayStation 1. Like, you have to, like, give it some real thought. And there are also two games that, like, where there are two consoles that work off of different media to try to deliver their games. One is CD, one is cartridges. And so it's like, it was an era where like third parties had to sort of like pick and choose more, like where their games went and how they made them, you know? And if like you're going to port a game, it was a way more substantial process than it is with like the PS4 and the Xbox One. And so like that was, one of the reasons why I have very complicated feelings on it was because I did not have a PlayStation 1. My neighbor had a PlayStation 1, so I played lots of, like, Crash Bandicoot, and I watched him play, like, a lot of Final Fantasy VII and stuff like that. but I was not, I didn't have a Sony console until the PlayStation 4 was the first one I ever bought. So I had, like you, an N64 when I was young. I had a Sega Genesis that my brother had that I sort of inherited. But then we got an N64, and I fell in love with games like Super Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time, and Pokemon Snap is fucking great.
It is.
Still great. And so, like, a lot of those games, and a lot of my memories of being a kid playing on the N64, like, that was such an amazing console. I loved playing Super Smash Brothers with four controllers and, like, four people. Like, my brother and my dad and I all played through Gauntlet Legends, which was on the N64. It was an arcade port. And it's like, that was, like, a huge amount of fun. I have a huge amount of great memories of playing with my friends and my family multiplayer on the N64, as well as Ocarina of Time being one of, like, I've talked about this on the podcast all the time, but it's being one of my really formative experiences, not for just for playing video games, but for, like, in general for me as a kid. But then at the same time, getting older, and I look back at it, it's like, all those, like, personal nostalgic experiences aside, and, like, and the huge exception of a handful of Nintendo-made games on the N64, the N64 is kind of a crap console. Like,
it kind of is. It's a weird thing to say. When it soared very high. A lot of those games are gorgeous and graphically much more impressive than anything on the PlayStation. But then there's a lot of just kind of middling stuff.
I mean, yeah, there were a lot of really bad games on the N64. And there were a lot of really bad games on the PlayStation 1 as well, because that was, like, those were the first successful 3D game consoles. So it's like, it makes sense that it's like, a lot of those games have especially aged poorly, but even back then, they were pretty fucking shit.
Yeah.
But, like, the PlayStation 1 had just generally a higher bar of quality than, like, the N64. Like, I own some N64 games that were, like, really bad, like Star Wars Battle for Naboo and shit like that. Just like, this is just trash. This is complete trash.
Absolutely. It's a weird thing. Like, the N64 clearly, I think, has greater pockets of, like, just depth than pretty much any console ever, if you look at some of the greatest games on
sure.
it. But the PlayStation had more breadth to it. You know, you had a pretty constant stream of pretty incredible games on the PlayStation that I'm still catching up with in some cases and going back to. And yeah, some of them haven't aged terrifically, but I think you can go play like Metal Gear Solid and get why it is so revolutionary and fun and interesting. But yeah, I mean, let's talk about those two big games.
Okay.
We're talking about them a lot. I mean, Mario 64 is one I played as a kid, have continued to play through my whole life.
Yeah, me too.
Just finished replaying it again the other day, because I have it on my Wii U, and I would just kind of off and on. I'm like, I'll go get a couple stars. And, I love that game. I think it has aged beautifully. I think it still controls as well as any 3D platformer ever. It's a glorious, glorious game. And Ocarina of Time was not really one I played as a kid, but I finally went back and played the entire game last year. And, oh my God, it's incredible. You do not have to have played that as a kid on the N64 to get that game. You can play it now, and I played the 3DS version, but I would have loved it just as much, I think, if I were playing the N64. You know, I didn't have to do all the stuff with the boots and the water cavern, but other than that, we're good.
Yeah.
And so that's incredible to me. You played both of those as a kid, I guess.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's... and it's interesting because I don't generally like 3D platformers or 2D platformers that much, but I do really love Super Mario 64, and I continue to go back to it and play it at different points in my life today and still can love it. And I think, like, for me, the thing with Super Mario 64 that makes it so amazing is the whole structure of the game is completely unlike basically any other 3D platformer. Like, it's the way, the specific balance of the hub world castle and then the, like, mystery objectives of going into the different, like, painting, like, world paintings. And it's like, the game is not about completing platforming challenges or being fast and stuff like that. I mean, there are parts of, like, the different objectives where you are asked to do that kind of stuff and need to do it to accomplish the specific objective. But Super Mario 64 is a game that is fundamentally about exploration, and that's what makes it such an engaging experience for me.
Absolutely.
Because it's like, and that's one of the things that makes it work as a 3D game, is that one of the huge, massive advantages of 3D gaming is that you have in a world that you can reasonably explore. It's like, you can have elements of that in 2D stuff, but side-scrolling games, like, there's an element of exploration. Like, when I played Sonic the Hedgehog 3, like, there's, like, stuff of, like, oh, cool, like, there's a path up here, and that's awesome, and you can go do that stuff. And you can find little hidden bits and pieces all over the place. But there's not that sense of, like, really being inside of a setting, being inside of a world, when it's having to be projected onto a 2D plane. When it's like, when you are just immersed as a character fully in a 3D environment, there is that sense of, like, I can go into these places. Like, I can find these weird hidden passages, and, like, there's a sense of depth, quite literally, to the world construction that you just can't have in a 2D game. And so Super Mario 64 was mind-blowing for that, because you could just go in and, like, jump into that Ba-Bomb painting, and you're just dropped into this big, like, open 3D level that you can just explore to your heart's content, and you're not locked onto, like, a, like, specific straight path that you just have to follow, and you can go up a little bit, and you can go down a little bit. It's like, no, like, I can go up here and to the right and, like, get into these cannons, or I can go down under here, and there's all these Ba-Bombs. I can go up across this bridge, I can go, like, skirt around the Chain Chomp, and, like, all, like, heading towards this big mountain to get to the top to fight this giant Ba-Bomb dude. Like, there's so many different pathways you can go and explore and find all the red coins and stuff like that. Which is, like, that's, to me, what made Super Mario 64 really remarkable.
Absolutely, and I'm someone who clearly loves platformers a lot, just in general. But I almost think of Mario 64 as a different thing, you know, as you're saying. Like, and it's worth repeating something we've talked about before on this podcast, that whereas, you know, Nintendo, after Ocarina of Time with Zelda, they kind of kept the Ocarina of Time template for every subsequent 3D Zelda game.
Yeah.
They were, I think, almost scared of repeating Mario 64.
Yeah.
Like, Mario Sunshine has elements of it where you do have these things you go into, but the hub world is much more fleshed out, and it's where a lot more stuff happens. And I don't think
it's much more about navigating specific jumps and stuff like that, as far as I remember
it. Well, because it has the water thing, which is a big platformer mechanic in that game. And then Mario Galaxy 1 also does something kind of similar, but in a very different way. And then starting with Mario Galaxy 2, they kind of went back to the more world-level structure. And while that's been great, and I think Mario Galaxy 2 is one of the very best games ever made, I think it's also, I would like to see Nintendo try to do something like Mario 64 again, because I think there's worth trying something like that again.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need them to repeat it 10 times like Zelda did, but I would be kind of interested to see, in HD with what they have now, what if you tried that kind of thing again?
Yeah.
And maybe you can't, because Mario 64 is such an utterly unique achievement.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, there is atmosphere in that game so thick, you could just physically slice it.
Yeah. God, when you get to, like, the Boo stuff, and, oh, like, you go down to, like, the basement, and you, like, find the Boo cage in the one Boo, and go into the Boo level, like, that... There's, like, shit like that was so amazing as a kid when you first find it, like, for the first time.
Yes.
Like, and it's like, holy, there's this whole other, like, level that's this crazy, like, haunted house level.
It's, I mean, it says something that I have almost certainly beat Mario 64 more than I've beat any other game ever. And I still will get into parts of it and be like, what do I do here? Mm-hmm. I don't remember. And then I'll just explore.
Yeah.
And I love that you can, I've been playing that game my whole fucking life at this point, and I can still have those feelings and experiences and get in there and just have this kind of sense of, there is something, and I use this word seriously here, sublime about that game, where you're just kind of in awe of the scope of it and the room it has for you and the room it has for different playstyles and exploration. And I also love just the simplicity of it. It's revolutionary when you think this was the first 3D game Nintendo ever made, for one. That's incredible. But it's also, it was the fourth or fifth big Mario game, so they've done Mario a lot. Mario had certain conventions, even though all the Mario games are very different. Mario 3 doesn't look like Mario 1, doesn't look like Mario World. But you have power-ups, and you have Yoshi, and you have things like that. You have friends, you have Luigi. None of that is in Mario 64.
Yeah.
You're just Mario. You don't encounter anyone else in the castle except the Boos.
And like the weird toads that sort of pop up and tell you stuff.
But otherwise, you're completely on your own.
Yeah.
You do not really have power-ups and transformations. You kind of, there's things like the wing hat and invisibility, but they're very minor and used very differently than any other kind of power-up.
Yeah, they're way more specific and situational than getting a mushroom in Super Mario Brothers is.
Yeah, so it's like you're playing Mario, but you're also being constantly retaught what Mario is and can be. And I think if anything speaks to the malleability of Mario as a character and a mascot, it is Mario 64.
Yeah.
That you could have that moment where you just put it all on Mario's shoulders. He's your avatar for this whole thing, and he's going to have those clothes and that hat and that color scheme the whole game. And it doesn't feel smaller. It feels much, much bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And this, although it is, I think, important to remember that, like, some of the things, there are some flaws with Super Mario 64 that are specifically, a lot of them are the limitations of the technology. Specifically, like, I think, for what, like, for being the first 3D game and for being on a console that does not have two control sticks, the camera is remarkable and incredibly, like, an incredible achievement. At the same time, Oh, it's, like, it is flawed, for sure.
Absolutely. And it's one of those fascinating things where I love that early 3D games had to narratively explain the camera.
Yeah, you have the Lakitu dude following you around. And, like, I love when you can go into some rooms that have mirrors in the castle and you can just see him there.
Well, it's fascinating because it's easy for us to accept, okay, it's just there's a camera. It's a 3D game. But if you had never seen a 3D game before, what would a camera in a game even mean? Like, why do we use that term, camera? And it's these guys like Miyamoto and the people making these first 3D games. They had to think through that. Those are actively acts of genius in the truest sense of the word, where you're making leaps that no one else can even see the end point of.
Yeah.
You know? And you get that here. You definitely get that in Zelda with some of the camera stuff there.
Yeah.
And how that has a very unique approach to doing that. Yeah, no, it's a flaw. There's some draw distance problems.
Yeah, the draw distance thing is the thing that makes it the hardest to go back to for me. Like,
yeah.
Specifically, like, there's a draw distance issue with, like, any sort of active sprite of, like, coins and stuff like that. That's just, like, seeing those things draw in, like, 5 feet in front of your face is like, oh my god, I can't do this anymore. Like, I have lost the skill to react to something doing that. Like, it's just, it's kind of terrifying to watch things draw in at such an extremely close distance to your character.
Yeah. But all in all, I mean, they're pretty minor things in terms of what's aged and what hasn't, you know?
Yeah, no, it is, yeah, like, most... Like, the vast, vast, vast majority of games age horribly. Yeah. So it's like Mario 64 having, like, a couple of minor things that, like, technically have not aged very well at all. Like, that's fine. Because the core of the game, like, shines through brilliantly.
I want to talk about certain things that haven't aged. Like, the controls are so good of how Mario moves and jumps and particularly swims. That's something I forget every time I go back. The swimming controls in Mario 64... Most games that have swimming today still don't do it as well.
Yeah,
like where you just—I feel like you can just move underwater and you don't have to think about it that much in Mario 64. It feels very natural, and it's something we're always struggling with. And even like I've tried to play Mario Sunshine several times. Part of why I can't get through Mario Sunshine is I just don't think it controls very well.
Yeah.
And luckily, you know, you get to Mario Galaxy and the subsequent ones, and they got that control back, and the controls have been very good. But it is, you can just jump into Mario 64 and it feels very fluid. You feel like you have control over Mario. He's got a pretty small move set, but the moves he has are all very useful and easy to execute on. Some of the only, I mean, there are parts like where there's one in the ice level where you have to do a wall jump up, and the wall jump is really tough in Mario 64.
Yeah, and part of that is a camera thing as well. Yes. The camera it can't accommodate for it very well.
Yeah, but other than that, I mean, it is amazing when I go back to that game and I'm like, I don't have to readjust myself that much, all things considered. So.
Yeah, no, yeah, the control in the game is more or less perfect for its era, especially, again, considering that, like, all the camera stuff has to be mapped to, like, the C buttons in a weird way, with, like, weird, like, prefab camera options, because, you know, they only had one control stick.
Yep. One of the things I will always be most amazed by in video game history is that Shigeru Miyamoto and Nintendo directed Super Mario 64 and The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time in a 2-year period on the same console, one after the other. Will we ever have a moment like that again? That's fascinating to me.
I mean, well, one, no, because it takes way more than 2 years to make a video game now. But I mean, it is like such a crazy 1-2 punch of like taking these two games that are like Mario and Zelda are two completely different Nintendo franchises. Like, there's very little similarities between the two. I mean, Mario is a, like, traditionally the 2D sense is a side-scrolling platformer. Zelda is like a top-down isometric exploration, like pseudo-action RPG kind of game, you know? Like, with like a puzzle element. Like, they are just completely different genres, and yet they both were translated to 3D at basically the same time, and they were both did it perfectly, but they're both, again, like going to 3D, they are very different kinds of games.
Yeah. So talk about Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, I mean, well, we talked about it a lot on this podcast, so we don't need to go super in-depth with it, but...
And it's something I know we kind of want to do an episode on at some point.
Yeah, yeah, whenever there's an opportunity for it to be specifically relevant. But yeah, like, I mean, it's, for me, Ocarina of Time, like, one of the things about it that, like with Super Mario 64, that was just intoxicating when I was, you know, that age, and when, like, I was only really used to playing 2D games on the Sega Genesis, is that sense of exploration, is that sense of this big 3D world. Like, it's that depth that, like, it's like, I give depth is such a cheesy term to use, which is just, like, talking, like, literally there's, a third depth dimension to the game. But, like, that is, like, that breathes into everything in that game, is that sense of depth. It's the sense of depth in the world, the sense of depth in the characters, in the writing, the sense of depth in, like, the combat. And it is just everything that suffuses that entire game of just, like, you are dropped into this world. You are given that little bit of context of like the Deku Tree and Navi sort of talking vaguely about what needs to be done, and you need to go to the Great Deku Tree. And the way that game just sort of like within like 5-7 minutes is able to just tutorialize you on basically all the controls as you get into the Great Deku Tree and you get all your equipment, and you like that whole section at the beginning where you're just exploring around and have to find like all the money. You know, like they just like that is a really important element of that game of where they're just like, hey, just walk around Kokiri Forest and just get like 40 rupees. And that's one of the first things they ask you to do in that game. And so you just have to run around in the grass and you have to go like behind weird things and crawl under holes and like hop on the three like platforms up top and get them like perfectly and stuff like that. And it's just like, hey man, get some money, buy a shield, like go find the sword to crawl through this hole. And to do that and to like navigate the rolling boulder section, you have to use the Z targeting stuff naturally to move the camera. And it's like the way that it sort of seamlessly tutorializes you on all these mechanics that had not ever been used in a game before then. And it like just teaches you to explore that environment. Like it's just you can just see within like the first 5 minutes how immaculate of a game it is just in terms of its raw game design. And it's that much more remarkable for having been the first game of its kind. And it just sort of instinctively knows to do those kinds of things to instruct you how to like find items in the world, because that's way more important, because that doesn't exist in like Mario 64. You don't need to like have to explore like the individual environments with that kind of depth in Mario 64 the way that you do in Ocarina of Time to like find its solutions to puzzles and to find money and to find the items that are hidden in the environment and stuff like that.
It's fascinating to me just to think of things like, obviously jumping is one of the central mechanics in Mario 64.
Yeah.
And then they go to Zelda and they very easily could have had a jump button.
Yeah.
But instead they're like, fuck it, don't need it. It's not a part of this game, so let's eliminate that and simplify it and put our resources elsewhere.
Yeah, just have contextual jumping.
Yeah. And those kind of choices are just so interesting to me. Especially if you roll off making one game where it's easier than mechanics,
yeah.
Roll onto another one, and certainly some lessons are taken from Mario 64, and you can see those in the DNA of the game. But some are just like, well, that worked for that game, but this is a different game, so let's be different.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about Ocarina of Time that is similar to what they kind of do with the camera in Super Mario 64, where they have to explain something so in-depth that is something you just take for granted today, is the A button being the like this contextual action button that is like does different things based on like where you are in the environment and how you're moving and stuff. And it's like there's like long stretches of text in the Great Deku Tree dungeon where like the little like fuckers that shoot the seeds at you, they have to explain like the A button is your contextual action button, which means that like depending on if you're running and you press A, you can roll, or if you're standing next to me and you press A, you can speak. It's like there's like multiple characters in the beginning of that game that have to tell you different things about what the A button does, when it's like nowadays you don't even need necessarily having the text next to the button prompt on the screen to be like, oh, if I press A, it talks, because the talk like thing is like right in front of the A button. It's like that's just a normal thing about the language of playing video games in 3D games nowadays. And it's like Ocarina of Time goes to such like kind of ludicrous pains to try to explain that concept to the player.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Ocarina of Time is just an amazing game.
Absolutely amazing. Like we would need a lot more time to go in depth on why. I will just say, you know, the things I realized. I want to talk about Z-targeting really quick.
Okay, yeah. Z-targeting is awesome.
Z-targeting is awesome, and I think we could still learn from it today.
Yeah.
Like, I think there are certain things like, yes, having your two sticks and free control over the camera is great. There is also something very liberating and stress-reducing about having that easy button where you just press it and you're looking at what you need to look at.
Yeah.
That's so revolutionary to me. Just simplify it. Like, we're going to be in a 3D plane, but when we don't have free camera control, what do? Just press Z and you look where he's looking.
Yeah.
Like, that is so smart that you would never think of it, you know?
Yeah.
And it still holds up, like, today. Like, there's in the Majora's Mask 3DS remake, that was made in conjunction with the new 3DS, which has a C-stick. So you can do free camera control in that version of Majora's Mask. And it is helpful because some parts of Majora's Mask are, how should I say this, much more oblique than Ocarina of Time ever was.
Really?
So it does help. But overall, there's a lot of points where I would be doing that, and then I'm like, no, I'm just going to hit L and target that way.
Yeah.
And because that's just easier to do, and it's what the game was built around. And I do think there are things, sometimes when I play a game today, and I'm like, you know, where it's that kind of action game, and I kind of wish there was something with the camera controls that I could just snap to. Because if you replay Ocarina of Time now, you get used to it, and you want to keep doing it for everything.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
And it's not only because, like, a lot of games do basically have a similar sort of concept to Z-targeting even today, but there's something that they generally miss that I think is like such a genius move on Ocarina of Time, is that there is a sound effect associated with Z-targeting, and there is a visual effect with, in terms of the screen basically going widescreen and the bars dropping from the top and bottom of the screen. Like, that does so much to orient the player's focus, along with the like sudden shift in the camera that like because plenty of games, I think Gravity Rush even has something where like I think if you press in on the right thumbstick you can like switch the camera immediately to behind the player's back, and I'll use that every now and then, but it's a very disorienting kind of camera move because it's like you don't have any way of positioning your frame of reference with how the camera has just moved, other than having to reference like the character models in the frame, which is something very hard to do that quickly. I think there's something about that like that psychological element of having the sound effect and the visual effect of the bars coming down that like orients the player kind of immediately with how they have just like Z-targeted. Yes. It's like that's such a small touch that is still, I think, just fucking cool in Ocarina of Time.
Oh, it's such a cinematic game.
Yeah.
To this day, I can't name a lot of other games that instill some of the feelings Ocarina of Time does, just in some of those little nonverbal cutscenes that are just so gorgeous and moving. Like when you first leave Kokiri Forest, like you've already done the Deku Tree, but now you're going to go to Hyrule Field, and your friend, who will later become one of the priests,
Saria,
she just stops you and you talk for a little bit, and then you leave, and it just hangs with her for a minute.
Yeah.
That's one of the most evocative moments in any game ever.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And then the whole end of that game is just them dropping the mic over and over and over. It's incredible. Just the last, you're in the castle and there's organ music playing, and you're in that castle for like an hour. You get to the top and the organ is Diegetic being played by Ganondorf. Who, of course, Ganondorf would just sit down at an organ and play to freak you out.
Yeah, because I mean, what else does he have to do? He took over the world already, like years ago.
And we're not even talking about the whole time mechanic. Yeah. Again, that those two games exist on one console, let alone were directed by the same person, let alone were worked on by largely similar teams, is just incredible.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine that kind of thing happening. I think the closest I can even think of now is something like The Last of Us into Uncharted 4, where you have this like shared DNA for two very different experiences, but even then that's not really comparable.
Yeah.
So... All right, those are the top two N64 games, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, those are some of the top two games, arguably, like bar none. Yeah. So, yeah.
Fill out your top five. We don't have to rank, but just fill out your top five.
Let's see. This is like, obviously, like I have not played a huge breadth of N64 games because I wasn't super into games at the time. Yeah. So this is like a very specific list to the games I owned. It would be like, and I'm not going to try to rank the other three off the top of my head. But it's definitely Ocarina of Time is one, and Super Mario 64 is two. And then Pokemon Snap is actually like totally in there. Pokemon Snap is fucking awesome. I don't care what anyone says.
No, it's a great choice.
Pokemon Snap is so fucking good. So the Pokemon Snap, Super Smash Brothers would be the other one. I'm trying to think of like...
You love Paper Mario.
Yes. Like Paper Mario is one that like almost transcends the idea of it even being an N64 game to me. Like it's like, it is so... Like, above everything that is wrong with the design of that console, it just exists on another level. But yes, Paper Mario would be... Paper Mario is three. Pokemon Snap would be four. And the Super Smash Brothers would be five.
Okay. All right. I'd go Mario 64 as one, and then Ocarina of Time as two.
I mean, you're wrong about that, but sure.
Okay, no, I mean, either ranking is fine. Let's see. So we have those, and then my other three in no particular order. Smash Bros, definitely. Smash Bros is number three, let's be honest, for me. Majora's Mask would be in there. I actually just finished that game. That game is a horrible final dungeon. Like one of the worst things I've ever played in a game ever. But the rest of that game I love so much, I will forgive that.
Like my memory of Majora's Mask was that the dungeons in general were sort of poor, but like some like the open like world, overworld stuff was cool.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that. I like the first three dungeons more. Like my brother Thomas has the same feeling as you that he didn't, and because I think both of you have played more Zelda than I have.
Yeah, that might inform some of it.
Yeah, he just doesn't love the dungeons in those games. I like them just fine, especially because of all the surrounding narrative material. And I really think that game does things that no one else has ever even tried to do in terms of some of its time mechanics and the way it tells stories and stuff. So even though that dungeon is a drag, the rest of the game I love. So that's on there. And then Mario Party 2. I have played a lot of Mario Party 2. It is one of my favorite multiplayer games. Part of this is nostalgia. My dad, my brother, and I would play that all the time. The weird thing where after my dad died, we played Mario Party 2 and found a game still in progress that he was playing with us. because he was always Wario, so Wario was in there. That was a weird feeling. Yeah. So, I mean, it's honestly, I have a strong association. Wario is my dad because my dad would always play Wario.
Okay.
It's a weird thing. Like, I cannot play Wario in games to this day.
Sure, yeah.
Because, like, I can play Wario Land, but just, like, if I'm doing a multiplayer, I can't pick that character because it's like, that's my dad, so I can't play that. So, anyway, it's like, you know, Mr. Lack was my father. I just can't do that. So, anyway, you got that. So, those are probably my top five. And I do think Mario Party 2 is the absolute pinnacle of that series and of that kind of weird subgenre.
Yeah, which is, like, not a pretty much. Harsh thing to say for, like, if, like, a franchise that is, like, at Mario Party 10 or 11 at this point.
Yes.
They peaked at 2.
No, they really did. I
mean, I basically agree with you. I had fun with the Mario Party games, and Mario Party 2 was the one we owned, so it's the one I played the most of by far.
Yeah.
But then, like, when... I mean, this was probably, like, 4 or 5 years ago the last time I played it, but I did go back to Mario Party 2 with some of my friends, and, like, going back to that game completely destroyed all of my memories of it. It's like, this game is fucking awful.
The
mini games in Mario Party games are terrible. They are really, really bad.
Yeah, no, I get it. I still enjoy it when I go to play it, but it's... It's in my. Those are definitely my top five. Honorable mentions would be things like Paper Mario.
Yeah,
Paper Mario would definitely be in the top there. But yeah, that's. And you know what? There's a lot of crap on the N64. That's a really top strong top five or six.
Yeah,
you can name. Yeah. And again, the top two are really good.
Yes.
So that's the N64. Anything else to say about it?
It feels weird that console is 20 years old.
It does.
I mean, it's 19 years old for the American release.
By the way, there's one game we forgot to mention that people will yell at us if we don't say. Yes, GoldenEye was on the N64.
Oh, fuck GoldenEye. That game sucks. I played that game when it was new and I hated it then.
I agree. But I wanted you to be the one to say it.
And then, like, I just fundamentally do not understand the nostalgia around GoldenEye. Like, I remember, because I did have, like, a friend who was super into GoldenEye, and that's how I played it, because I didn't own it. But I would go to his house, and we would play it, like, 4-player split screen. And it's like, every time I was like, this game fucking sucks.
I think it looks bad. I think it sounds bad. I think it controls bad. Yeah,
man, that game is awful.
And I don't think it was ever good to begin with. It has aged so horribly. Like, as well as Mario 64 has aged, that is how poorly GoldenEye has aged.
GoldenEye, not very good. Mario Kart 64 was also that. Like, I really enjoyed Mario Kart 64 when I was a kid and I would play with my brother, but that was another one where, like, I went back to it. It's like, nope, this is unplayable. Yeah. This is completely unplayable.
It pretty much is now. And that's okay. That's such an iterative kind of genre. You can understand.
Yeah, but, like, there are, like, other kart racers of the era, like Crash Team Racing and stuff, that's, like, has aged much better. Like, I think Mario Kart 64 was always kind of not that good.
Yeah. Like, even the original Mario Kart for SNES probably has aged better, I would say.
Probably, so, you're right.
Yeah. But anyway, GoldenEye, we don't really care about it. I know some people do, but...
And it's like, get over it, you know? It was never that good. Yeah. Like, I get it. Like, it was, like, when I see my first-person shooter, but...
But some people, like, I still see to this day, N64 ranking lists where GoldenEye is number one.
Yeah.
And it pisses me off because you're ignoring these two pillars that have kind of held up all 3D games since.
Yeah, that where it's, like, GoldenEye, like, the one thing that, like, GoldenEye is, like, somewhat influential for in the first-person shooter genre is that it was one of the first games to do location-specific damage, like, where, like, shooting someone in the head, they would, like, animate differently and stuff like that. Like, that is important. Like, other games were basically doing that at the time. It's not, like, that unique in it. It's like, GoldenEye is a pretty, like, sort of forgettable entry in the genre.
I agree, because also, the other thing people try to say is, it's like, it was the first console shooter. It's like, Doom was on every fucking console under the sun. What are you talking about?
Yeah, and Doom controls fine on a console, too, because it was before, like, mouse aim for PC games.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I think GoldenEye did some important things in terms of multiplayer and stuff, just to popularize that.
Yeah.
But, again, especially when Halo was, like, 3 years later, I don't know how you can think GoldenEye was that influential. Just, I mean, think of the jump from GoldenEye in, like, 95 to Halo in 2000.
Yeah, it's insane. GoldenEye's not that good.
All right.
People should get over it.
But the N64, good console. With flaws.
Yeah, with flaws. Like, it is a complicated console.
Yes.
In a lot of ways, and its place in history.
But I can't imagine life without it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like it is both, like, in some ways, it is Nintendo's worst console they've made that succeeded, that wasn't just, like, the Virtual Boy, but then also it is kind of my favorite Nintendo console. So it's like, I don't know how to sort of fix those things. I don't know how to, like, bridge that weird gap, but that is how I feel about the N64.
Yeah. Let's talk about something else we have very complicated feelings on.
Yes.
Sonic the Hedgehog!
Sonic the motherfucking Hedgehog.
Sonic the motherfucking Hedgehog, he turned 25 this week on June 23rd.
He's kind of getting old.
Yes,
he's
getting
up there.
He's getting old, and we love Sonic the Hedgehog.
I desperately love Sonic the Hedgehog.
Even though we probably don't love the majority of his games.
No, I don't.
Yeah. All right, Sean, you have a longer history with Sonic than I do.
Yes.
Although I will say, Sonic and his early 3D games for me is what was so influential, because I kind of went back to his 2D games later. But, you know, Sonic Adventure 1 and 2, 2 in particular, hugely influential on me as a kid, and still some of my favorite games ever. And the Sonic games I love desperately and passionately.
Yeah.
And the Sonic games I hate, I find fascinating. So, Sean, you take it away.
Yeah, so like I mentioned this earlier, but for me, Sonic the Hedgehog is... Sonic the Hedgehog 3, specifically, on the Sega Genesis, is like the first game I can... video game I can remember playing. I maybe played a different Sega Genesis game actually first, but that was like the one that, like, I played Sonic the Hedgehog 3 all the time when I was a kid. Just constantly. One, because... like, going through some of my old Sega Genesis games, I realized we did not have a lot of very good games on the Sega Genesis. Like, there are a lot of other, like, really awesome Genesis games that we just never owned. But, like, so Sonic the Hedgehog 3 was head and tails above all everything else we had. But like, it was also just, like, an amazing game. And it wasn't just that I loved Sonic the Hedgehog 3 as a game. And then eventually I also got Sonic and Knuckles from a friend who was, like, sort of giving away a lot of his Genesis stuff. And so I was like, hey... give me that Sonic & Knuckles cart you have instead of, like, selling it to GameStop for, like, 25 cents or something. And this was, like, a long time ago. This was, like, when the Dreamcast was new. So then I also eventually got Sonic & Knuckles, so I have Sonic 3 & Knuckles still today. But, like, it was went beyond that for me, where it's, like, I didn't just like Sonic the Hedgehog 3 as a game. Like, I loved that character. I loved, like, the designs. I loved the sort of the nascent sort of universe that they had. Obviously, it wasn't very, like... fleshed out. It wasn't like The Witcher or something, but there was a sense of, like, kind of mythos to Sonic that especially, like, Sonic the Hedgehog 3 did a lot to develop, and I just loved that. And then there were the two cartoons, the, like, sort of the really insane, weird, like, sort of comedy cartoon, and then there was the unbelievably amazing and sort of, like, weirdly dark Saturday morning cartoon, which is the Sonic the Hedgehog cartoon that people still, like, remember today, is the basis for the still ongoing Archie Comics Sonic the Hedgehog series that has been going since, like, the early 90s,
and
spawned off of that cartoon.
And the ongoing cosplay and furry community.
Sure, yeah, there's that side of it as well. Like, I mean, and it like, speaks a lot to the design of Sonic the Hedgehog in that universe that, like, whatever you think of, like, that side of the Sonic the Hedgehog fan base, it inspires a passion in people that is, like, distinct and very unique among video game franchises because... like, and, like, any Sonic the Hedgehog fan will tell you, most of the games today are complete garbage. Like most Sonic the Hedgehog games have been garbage for longer than they were expected to have been good. Like, and it's been that way for a while. Like, people who, like myself, who are fans of Sonic the Hedgehog are not hiding that fact. But there is something about the character that, especially compared to the, like, mascot-like video game characters of his day, like, when you put Sonic the Hedgehog and Mario next to each other, to me, it's like putting Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse together. It's like... yes, Mickey Mouse is an important, like, influential character, and I like his visual design, but he is completely devoid of character. There is no character to Mickey Mouse. There is no character to Mario. You cannot name a character trait that Mario possesses because he does not possess any. He never has. He never will. Even in, like, Paper Mario, which is a, like, story-focused, long, like, 30-hour RPG, Mario himself is like, he's silent, and they don't even try to project much of a sense of personality onto him the way that, like, the Persona games do. Like, plenty of JRPGs have more or less silent protagonists that they still create a bit of personality around them. Even Paper Mario doesn't even really try to do that with Mario. And so when you put those, like, things together and you look at Sonic, and it's like there are things about Sonic that I think are, just through his visual design, like, it's very 90s, like, that attitude thing. But, like, even if it is kind of silly and it's very dated, like, it is still something that Sonic the Hedgehog had that most of, like, his contemporary mascot characters just didn't possess. And then when you combine that with the character that they created in the Saturday morning cartoon, which is this, I think, a legitimately interesting character who is kind of, like, he is the hero character and he's, like, trying to do good things and he is helping people. But at the same time, you know, it's an obvious choice, but they, like, link his sort of, like, very fast speed that he has with, like, this impatience that is, like, this, like, dramatic character flaw that Sonic has. And it's, like, and that's, like, what a character needs is, like, it's not just that, like, he has identifiable personality traits, but some of them are negative traits. And he makes mistakes, and he fucks things up, and it's, like, then he has to try to fix them. It's, like, that is the basis of a good character for a kid's cartoon, and it's, like, that element of that is, like, what has, like, made me a Sonic the Hedgehog fan and not just someone who liked some of those games. And even today, like, I still think Sonic the Hedgehog could work if Sega could get their shit together, because there is something, there's obviously something there about that character and about the other cast of, like, Tails and Knuckles and Dr. Robotnik and those characters. That's, like, there is something there that has captured a massive fan audience. And I wish Sega could rekindle that in some way.
Oh, absolutely. And I want to go back to one of your points just now about the respective personalities of Sonic and Mario.
Yeah.
Because I don't think you're saying that's necessarily a flaw with Mario.
No, like, it's that's what Mario needs to be.
Right.
Yeah.
And but I think that's interesting, because I think part of Mario being sort of milquetoast and bland is that it's allowed them to be more malleable with Mario.
Yeah.
And Mario can constantly be reinvented. He can be in RPGs, he can be in sports games, he can be in platformers.
Yeah.
And you're never going to have story or character get in the way of that. And one of the problems, not a problem necessarily, but one of the interesting things with Sonic is that he has so much attitude from the very beginning. You know, in Sonic 1, if you stand there and you wait too long, he'll, like, cross his arms and start stomping his foot like, the fuck are you doing? Yeah. I want to play my game. I want to roll around.
Yeah, I want to fucking run. I'm Sonic the Hedgehog. It's right in my name.
And so that means, inevitably, you have to get to a point where you are telling more complex stories with Sonic and his cast of characters.
Yeah.
And then you enter the realm of artistic risk, where once you're telling a story and once you have dialogue and once that attitude becomes more than just sort of set dressing, there are positives and negatives. And I think the Sonic Adventure games generally handle that pretty well.
I agree, yeah.
And
for,
then you
for
get
the day, especially.
Yes, and then you get kind of past that, and it's up and down and up and down and mostly down, and you get to stuff like Sonic 06, where they try to get really ambitious with it and they just flop flat on their face and things like that. And so, yes, I totally agree. If they get their shit together, it could totally work. But I also see there is kind of a natural progression where Sonic being so characterized means he can, in some ways, be much harder to do than Mario, who you just need solid game mechanics to make a good Mario game. You kind of, at this point, have to be able to do a lot of things well to do a good Sonic game.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think they've kept on messing up with Sonic is there's a handful of things that if, like, you want to look at the history of Sonic the Hedgehog to identify why the games now are so bad. I think there's a couple of things. Like, one, I don't think, other than, like, arguably Sonic Generations, which did it pretty fucking well, they have never 100% nailed translating Sonic to 3D. Like the Sonic Adventure 1 and 2 games I like a lot, and some of those Sonic the Hedgehog levels in them are really good. But at the same time, like, they never really got it. And I think, like, the Sonic the Hedgehog, the original Genesis games are great, but they are also very weird because they're, like, they are technically 2D platformers. Like, there's no other way to, like, sort of describe it. It is a side-scrolling platformer. But at the same time, there's something almost indescribable about the way that Sonic the Hedgehog plays that is, like, you do not play Sonic the Hedgehog the way you do Super Mario Brothers or almost any other 2D platformer. Like, they're almost kind of like time attack games in terms of, like, trying to find a way to navigate the environment the quickest way possible, which is, like, what makes Sonic the Hedgehog really rewarding for me, who, like, played those games all the time as a kid, is that I can play them skillfully. Like, I can still play Sonic the Hedgehog 3 well today because I remember enough about the levels, and that is hugely rewarding to do in a way I never really got into with the Mario games.
Platformers are games you play slowly.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that's, they are leisurely by their nature. You can run as Mario and all this stuff, but generally you kind of, you move through it, you kind of see the level, you see an obstacle, you figure out how you're going to go past it. And if you look at how platforming elements have informed games today, that is still part of it. Like, the platforming parts of Uncharted, for instance, are kind of slow. You climb, and you hear the dialogue, and you move leisurely, and that's why those parts are so interesting and relaxing. Sonic was never like that.
Yeah. It's about moving fast, it's about getting through those levels. It's why, like, one of my favorite things to do in video games even today is the, like, running at an enemy and then, like, hitting down and rolling to destroy them. And, like, because you then keep moving. And it's, like, it's that ability, or, like, the really nice bounce that Sonic has when he defeats enemies. It's obviously a very common thing in platformers, but there's something specific about the momentum of it that I feel like is really intoxicating in a way that, like, the Mario games, like, it has that element of it, but, like, I never feel like, man, I love just, like, being able to bounce off of a series of enemies in a 2D Sonic game because it's, like, to, like, get across a gap or something. There's, like, an element of skillful play to it, of being able to play it as quickly as possible and find one of the many different routes that is in those Genesis games, because they designed them so it's like there are three or four different sort of like branching paths that intersect throughout the level that you can kind of get up on and get and like fall down to. And in general, the highest path is the fastest because it's the hardest to navigate. And stuff like that is just awesome. I love those games to death.
Absolutely.
But then at the same time, when you get to 3D Sonic, like, one, they never like found a way to translate those game elements to it. But then also, when they did start hitting on stuff that was working, like Sonic Adventure and Sonic Adventure 2, then they like made Sonic Heroes, which was like similar, but like a little bit too far off the beaten path. Then they made Sonic 2006, which is like also like similar to how the Sonic Adventure games, but a little bit off the beaten path. And then they started making the Wii games, where they just went to something, a completely different model. Like those, like the Wii games, like Sonic and the Secret Rings and those, are like different games completely. They just abandoned like all the narrative stuff that they had developed, they basically abandoned. Like, they abandoned all the fucking voice actors from Sonic Adventure 1 and 2, which I am still sore about, because they had a really good voice cast in those
games. They absolutely did. What happened was they made that Sonic X.
Yeah.
And then they used those voice actors, which was the four kids cast. And some of those people are talented, just not in that context.
Yeah.
So
they did that, and then it's like, and then like it feels like they keep on doing new things, like, and then eventually like they come like to Sonic Generations, where it's like it felt like, oh, like you kind of built up something in Sonic Unleashed and Sonic Colors, where you stayed on a similar sort of like gameplay style as those, and you've built up on them and improved them, because they're like, those are like imperfect games. And then you get to Sonic Generations, where it's like, oh man, some of the 3D levels in Sonic Generations are really awesome. They're great. Like, some of the, like, they're like the best levels in Sonic Generations are some of the 3D levels. Like, some of those 3D levels are like awesome and amazing in the way that they manage 3D navigation in the Sonic game. I was like, they've never managed to do this as well before. And then they made Sonic Lost Worlds and completely abandoned everything they had built up to in Sonic Generations. And they just, like, abandoned their entire movement mechanics. It's like, why would you do that? You finally nailed it. Like, keep on improving it. And they just keep on chucking everything away.
No, weirdly, Sonic Team and Sega have this weird ADD, creatively, where every time they're onto something, they run away from it.
Yeah. Which they also then did with, like, Sonic Lost Worlds, which was, I never really played it. I didn't have much interest in it, but it seemed like, it wasn't a great game, but some people kind of liked what it did, but most people were bummed out that it's like, this is a bad fall to Sonic Generations. And then they made Sonic Boom that everyone under the sun just looked at and is like, this is awful. Like, the character redesign is awful. The, like, gameplay stuff is awful. Like, nobody likes Sonic Boom. Like, and it's like, Sonic Boom is a completely different kind of fucking Sonic game. Like, I haven't played it, but I watched enough video to sort of, like, I was just curious what it was. It was like, it's like a 3D exploration platformer kind of game. It's like, that's not... You had this, like, awesome kind of racetrack thing that you got onto with Sonic Generations. And then you did a weird, like, Mario Galaxy with Sonic Lost Worlds. And then you go back, like, to almost like a Sonic Adventure 1 style thing, but even more kind of open world-ish? Like, what the fuck are you doing?
Well, and we're also, you know, not explicitly saying with some of these games, like Sonic 06, Sonic Boom, that technically they were broken.
Oh, yes, no, for a long time, the Sonic the Hedgehog games, other than Sonic Generations, was more or less technically sound, have been, like, poorly made games. Like, regardless of the game mechanics, like, just technically in terms of, like, frame rate and stuff like that, and glitches, like, yes, low times in particular for Sonic 2006.
We'll get there, Sean.
Yes, we will. But, like, yeah, the technical side of the game says it has been very poor for a long time.
And it's amazing because you're not going to find a lot of games from that era more technically impressive than the first three Sonic the Hedgehog games.
Absolutely. That blast Sonic processing, my friend.
No, I think they're some of the most beautiful 2D games ever made.
I love the way they look.
Yeah, and they hold up on any screen. They've been re-released to every platform under the sun now, and they always look good. You know, I'm really happy with my Xbox One. They've put Sonic 1, 2, 3, Knuckles, and CD on backwards compatibility. Yeah. I really hope they get Sonic Adventure 1 and 2 out also, because that would be great if I had them all on one console again. And it's been fun to go back and play some of those on my Xbox One and have those, because those ports were so good. They still hold up in 1080p and everything.
Yeah.
And those games are just gorgeous. Sonic 1, 2, and 3, and then in Knuckles, and CD, which is, it was on a different platform, but I kind of think of it as a Genesis game, because it kind of looks the same.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Sega CD was attached to the Genesis, so
that's right,
you'd be forgiven for thinking of it that way.
Yes. So, they're all really just beautiful games. The colors and the detail in them, even though you're moving through the stages very fast, and they could have kind of, slagged off on that and not really paid attention to the detail. They never did. They really put a lot of effort into that. The music is so good and so fun to listen to.
Oh, man.
I mean, some of those have two soundtracks, the Japanese and the American, and they're both great.
Yeah, yeah. Which, Sonic CD has Japanese and American, and the Sonic CD Xbox Live Arcade release is great because it allows you to switch between the two.
Yeah. So, you just like there's so many choices and so much fun to have there, and they are all just very polished games. They move beautifully. There's some things in like Sonic 1 and 2 where you'll get killed in kind of cheap ways, but then you get to like Sonic 3, which is just so fucking polished.
Yeah.
So those games are really technically impressive, and while there are some problems in Sonic Adventure 1 and 2, for the time and what they were trying, there's a lot of impressive things about those as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I really like Sonic the Hedgehog.
When Sonic is good, there's very little that's better. Can we say that?
And it's so unique. There's like, there's nothing quite like it. And it's also just weird stuff of like, it's dumb, but I love that they just straight up ripped off the Super Saiyan thing from Dragon Ball Z. And this is like, Sonic just goes Super Saiyan and he gets all the Chaos Emeralds. Like, and fuck it. Yeah, it's a blatant ripoff, but going Super Saiyan is like the coolest thing that anyone has ever like invented from their head in the history of the human race, like as an artistic decision. Super Saiyan is just like cool personified, and Sonic the Hedgehog is also cool personified, so of course he can just go Super Saiyan. It's a natural extension of Sonic the Hedgehog.
I love it too, because when you actually put it in context and the time, it wasn't a ripoff like 10 years later.
No, yeah, it was because, like a contemporary ripoff.
Yeah, because I think in the anime, he goes Super Saiyan in 92, 93.
Yeah, which is when basically Sonic the Hedgehog 2 came out, which was because he couldn't go Super Sonic in Sonic the Hedgehog 1 because there were only 6 Chaos Emeralds. It was until 2 that they put that mechanic in.
Because it's 7 Chaos Emeralds also, right?
Yeah, yeah. Now, so, yeah. Like, seven they put another Chaos Emerald in for Sonic the Hedgehog 2, and then with that, they put in the Super Sonic mechanic.
Yeah. So they were like, you know, reading their Dragon Ball and Weekly Shonen Jump, and they're like, this is awesome! Can we put this in our game?
Yeah, that's basically what it felt like.
And it's, yeah, no, if you're going to rip off the best and rip off lovingly, and that's what they did.
Yeah. And then, like, also, like, that Super Sonic thing was the coolest thing when I was a kid, because that's one of the things that, like, Sonic the Hedgehog 3 starts with. You are on Tails' plane, on a biplane. You're flying to Angel Island. Sonic the Hedgehog just jumps off it like nobody's business, like whatever. I'm just going to jump off the top of this goddamn biplane. And then he flies off the screen. And then he comes back on the screen like running on the surface of the water as Super Sonic. Because it is a chronological follow-up to Sonic the Hedgehog 2. And then Knuckles hits him and takes all the Chaos Emeralds. It was like that idea of like, if I find all these hidden Chaos Emeralds in the environment, then, like, you can become Super Sonic and play as him in the game and, like, get the best ending and all that stuff. And that was, like, one of the things that I wish they had done more in the 3D games is capture that sense of, like, yeah, you can just play through the game and beat it and fine, like, that's all good. Or, if you play through the game and, like, also beat all these special stages and everything, you get the ability to, in the level, when you get 50 rings, jump in, like, do your highest jump, and then he just turns into Super Sonic, is invincible, and runs super fast and jumps twice as high. Like, that was so amazing the first time you got to play as Super Sonic when you finally nailed it and, like, got enough Chaos Emeralds, and you could just do that in the game. That was the most incredible feeling. Like there is nothing that can replicate that in any game I could play today, because it's just, like, Just like euphoria, basically, when you can, because it was so hard to do, and then like when you finally fucking did it, it was so awesome because you went Super Saiyan and Sonic just like controlled perfectly, like he just like because being Super Sonic in Sonic the Hedgehog 2 and 3 is like you are completely out of control 100% of the time. He moves way too fast, he jumps way too high, you cannot control anything that fucking guy does, but somehow if you're like you can still get to the end of the level and just be like, I don't even know what I just did. Like, I just, like, zoomed through everything. It's incredible.
Yes. Absolutely. So, anything more to say about those early games?
They're awesome.
They're so good. I love them. And, you know, they were not my childhood games, but I go back to them every once in a while, and, they're so fun to play, and I think there's so much... I do think the way they marry traditional platforming with something so unique and different... It's just, again, there are no games like those Sonic games, including later Sonic games.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily wrong, because it's very... I think they had a much taller order, I think, than Mario or Zelda did in going 3D.
I agree.
And they didn't, obviously, achieve those same heights, but I think it was, again, I think it was a harder task. So, let's talk about the 3D games.
Okay.
I'm going to jump ahead to Sonic Adventure 2, just because that is the first one I played.
Yeah.
This friend's house that I said I was over at the other day, you know, I saw him playing. It was City Escape, and it was love at first sight for both me and my brother, because we're like, you can run around the city and get chased by the fucking, you know, like that game is such a
big truck.
That game is such a great opening. That is something actually all Sonic games or mini Sonic games do very well, is just the openings. Like Sonic 3, great first scene.
Yeah.
Sonic 2, great first scene. I love all of those.
Yeah.
I guess if you're playing the hero side, the dark side is a good first scene too. But anyway. But like Sonic Adventure 2 is one. My brother played it over and over again as a kid. He loved that game. And he was, you know, he's younger than me, obviously.
Yeah.
So that was like his big game as a kid. And then as Sonic Adventure 2 became a huge hit on the GameCube, so they released Sonic Adventure 1 afterwards.
Sonic Adventure 1 DX.
DX. And then they did a set with the Genesis games, a set with the CD games. They had a bunch of sets. And so my brother got all of those and just played them religiously. He loved Sonic as a kid. And I think still does. He has them all now on his PC through Steam.
Right,
so he loves doing that. But I played Sonic Adventure 2 also, and I just remember the period of time where we just played Sonic Adventure 2 all the time. And if I wasn't playing it, I might be watching my brother play it while I played something else or something. Yeah. We just loved playing that game, and I can recognize some of the flaws in the Sonic Adventure games now, but I also want to speak to their strengths.
Yeah,
I think they have, very similar to me, I think of them similarly to Mario 64 in terms of atmosphere.
Sure.
I think Sonic Adventure 1 particularly, and then Sonic Adventure 2 in different ways, there are parts where the atmosphere, again, is just so thick you could slice it. Like the parts in Sonic Adventure 1 where you're on the island and kind of roaming around, there are imperfections there, but it's also like with the music and the sense of discovery and exploration, it's like, this is really cool.
Yeah.
There's just something weird going on. And then in Sonic 2, you have this, Sonic Adventure 2, you have this crazy sci-fi story going on.
Yeah, man, the story of that game.
You have all these characters getting together. You have all these different play styles. And so, yeah, the Knuckles treasure hunting levels are not the most exciting levels.
They are terrible.
Okay.
They are awful levels.
Can I make my case?
Sure.
I've never thought they were awful. I see what you're saying. But I also think there's something kind of interesting that I'd never quite played something in a game like that, where you have these different play styles all under one roof, and you can have this big, awesome blockbuster Sonic or Shadow level that's really fun.
Yeah.
And then you get into the treasure hunting, and it's just something different, and you have all this exploration to do, and there's these big kind of worlds to go explore, and you've got the music overhead and stuff, and that's all kind of cool. And then maybe you find the Chao Key, and then you go to your Chao Garden and stuff like that.
We'll talk about the Chao Garden.
It's just all of that in Sonic Adventure 2 and 1, because I think of them as backwards, because I played 2 first, obviously, and then 1, because I did not have a Dreamcast as a kid. There's so much atmosphere and exploration and things to discover and have fun with, and it was both of those games, but 2 in particular, rewarded replay so intensely, because you have all the emblems you can go get, and you can just go replay levels to your heart's content, and you can see the story again, and then if you do everything right and you get to the end, you have kind of the final true ending, and there's a bunch of cool stuff there. I think the story is pretty good for how crazy it gets, and I love a lot of the character moments and stuff.
Yeah.
So I really loved Sonic Adventure 2, and then when I've gone back and played Sonic Adventure, which I do not know as well, I find Sonic Adventure to be an intensely fascinating game.
Yeah.
I think it's very flawed in a lot of ways, but I also think what it was trying and what it was doing was so ambitious. I think it's actually a really great game to put on the shelf next to things like Ocarina of Time and Mario 64 and Final Fantasy VII and Metal Gear Solid, of these games that were 2D franchises that then went 3D, and how did they all do it differently? Well, all those ones I named were more successful than Sonic Adventure, but Sonic Adventure is almost interesting because it was in some ways even more ambitious in how it just tried to kind of blow up the franchise and do it differently.
Yeah.
And the parts that work beautifully, and the parts that don't are fascinating. I don't find them frustrating. I find them kind of interesting as like this artistic puzzle to unlock and kind of figure out how this all came together. And again, with just some really interesting atmospheric things where it felt like they were maybe learning from how the television series at the time were doing really cool, interesting, different things.
Yeah.
So I really love the Sonic Adventure games, and I've always thought it was, even though I like Sonic Heroes, I think it's an okay game.
Yeah.
It's really too bad they abandoned that and never really followed up.
Yeah, they never did it Sonic Adventure 3, which is what you wanted Sonic Heroes to be, and it's like, Sonic Heroes is fine, I guess, but it's like,
there's some standout levels and parts, but it's much more meh
than
it should be. So, you hate treasure hunting.
Oh, I mean, they're just bad levels. Like, I don't know. I mean, some of them are okay, and I get, like, I definitely understand, like, the, you know, it's fun to be able to explore the 3D environments and stuff, and I really like Knuckles. I mean, they've very poorly used Knuckles a lot, but, like, when Knuckles is nailed, I think he's a really cool character. But, like, some of those motherfucking treasure hunt levels are, like, I play them in my nightmares. It's just...
The aquatic mine.
The aquatic mine. I have such a, like, weird love-hate relationship with the music in Sonic Adventure 1 and 2, where it's, like, some of it is great, and, like, some of it is, like, great, but also, like, kind of terrible and so insanely dated, but I still love it. And then you have the rap music in the Knuckles sections that's, like...
I love it.
The aquatic mine one is... I forget what the line is, but it's, like, aquatic mine. It's, like, you don't say the name of the level in your fucking rap, dude. Like, that's so lame. Like, just all that rap music is so unbelievably terrible. Like, the whole mechanic of having to just go around and do, like, these stupid fucking, like, scavenger hunt bullshit things for, like, having to get, like the Master Emerald Fragment, like, icon to sort of, like, blink faster and faster and faster to find it. And just, like, an aquatic mine, you have to, like, do all the fucking, basically, like, the water temple stuff from Ocarina of Time that is really annoying, of having to lower and raise the water levels over and over and over again, which is a very bad mechanic to have in, like, this scavenger hunt thing where you are constantly trying to move around all over the level, just trying to get a blip on your fucking thing. Those levels are awful. And then it's like, and then it's not even just the Knuckles ones. I think the Rouge ones are even worse, like, when they try to make them, because, like, the dark side of the campaign is, like, the harder ones. And, like, when you try to, like, up the difficulty on those, that's not very good. You also have that terrible, like, ghost boss fight. That one is awful, where you're just, like... Because it takes, like, 15 minutes to play it, even if you're doing well. The treasure hunt missions are awful. Just, like, across the board in that game. I'm trying to look up some of the lyrics to the Knuckles rap music, just so I can... Okay, here we go. So this isn't from one of the level themes, but this is the Knuckles character theme.
Oh, I can recite this from
her. Unknown from ME.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to... I mean, do you want to actually try to recite it from her?
You'd have to give me a place to start it. But
it's from the beginning. It starts with the words, "Here I come."
Oh, what is it?
There's no way you can do it. Okay. I will read some of the lyrics from Unknown from ME, Knuckles theme. "Here I come, rougher than the rest of them, the best of them, tougher than leather. You can call me Knuckles. Unlike Sonic, I don't chuckle. I'd rather flex my muscles. I'm hard as nails. Ain't hard to tell. I break them down whether they're solid or frail. Unlike the rest, I'm independent. It's my first breath, first test. Feel the right, then the worst's left." Whatever the fuck that means. "Born on an island in the heavens, the blood of my ancestors flows inside me. My duty is to save the flower from evil deterioration. I will be the one to set your heart free. Must cleanse yourself of that evil spirit that got in you. Streaking lights, loud sounds, and instinct are the elements that keep me going. I am fighting my own mission. Nothing's going to stand in my way."
Some of that is sung. There's the R&B part in the middle.
Kind of, yeah. But awful.
No, not great. That's the best one, by far. the Pumpkin Hill.
I just remembered Pumpkin Hill. I'm going to bring up Pumpkin Hill lyrics.
"Down at Pumpkin Hill, I gotta find my lost beat."
Yeah, it's... Man.
"I can sense it in my feet.
You know me, the fighting freak Knuckles, and we're at Pumpkin Hill. You ready?" So again, already it's like, how lazy are you writing the lyrics of the song that's like you're just throwing the fucking, like, level name in it? It'd be like writing a rap for Green Hill Zone and sort of just like... Like, "Hey, yo, dog, we're in Green Hill Zone." It's like, don't do that. That's like you wrote that lyric down and then, like, you never went back to change it. Because you're just, like, writing something to say, like, I just need to start writing. And then eventually I'll come to get to something good. And it's like, they never did. So they just left it in there. "I ain't gotta let it get to me. I'm just gonna creep down in Pumpkin Hill. I gots to find my lost piece. I know that it's here. I can sense it in my feet. The great emerald power allows me to feel. I can't see a thing, but it's around somewhere. I'm going to hold my head because I have no fear."
I know this one, yeah.
"This probably seems crazy. A graveyard theory. A ghost tried to approach me and he got leery. I asked him a question and he vanished in a second. I'm walking through valleys, crying pumpkins in the alley. Didn't seem happy, but they sure tried to get me. Had to back him up with the first metal crack 'em. I'm hearing someone saying, 'You a chicken, don't be scared.' I had to be the wind, because nobody wasn't there. I searched and I searched as I climbed up the wall, and then I started to fly. I went in deeper. Let it get to me? I'm just going to creep Down in Pumpkin Hill, I got to find my lost piece. I know that it's here. I can sense it in my feet. The Great Emerald's power allows me to feel. Like, that line is just like, doesn't fit anything in the fucking rhyming scheme at all.
Here's the thing about this song, and I feel this whenever I replay these games and hear these songs. I feel like the artist wants to drop a motherfucker in there,
yeah,
like over and over, and especially on the Pumpkin Hill one. I can just hear the places where the word motherfucker is supposed to be dropped, and it isn't, and it's distracting.
Yeah, like these are just, like it's just so awful. A ghost tried to approach me, and he got leery. I asked him a question, and he vanished in a second. Like, it's just like, it's like he's just trying to describe things that are in the, like, again, it's like with him putting Pumpkin Hill at the top of the song. It's like he's just played the level and was just writing down lyrics of, like, I search and I search as I climb up the wall, and then I started to fly. Like, you're just describing what you're doing playing the fucking level, asshole.
If Randy Newman was a rapper, this is what it would sound like.
Exactly. It's the exact same quality. It's like, God. So,
okay, what do you like about the Sonic Adventure games?
The Sonic and Shadow levels are really, really good. And okay. I should say, like, I played Sonic Adventure on the Dreamcast at this, like, the friend's house. It's the same friend who gave me his Sonic & Knuckles car. And so I, like, played Sonic Adventure that way. And then I got Sonic Adventure 2 on the GameCube, which was the first game I got for the GameCube. And then I later got Sonic Adventure DX. So I played sort of both of those games when they were new. And yeah, like, I really love the story stuff they do. Like, obviously, like, if you go back to it now, it seems, like, really ridiculous. And, like, but video game stories of the time, like, lots of games didn't try them, especially, like, more, like, action-y kind of games like that. And I think for the era, they're pretty well done. I think they do a good job at, like, characterizing Sonic and Tails and Amy and Knuckles. And, like, they do a really good job of all that stuff. I wish that some of the Chaos Emerald stuff was more, like, hidden in the levels and you got the Sonic supersonic power. But, like, I do think, like, the way that they sort of create a larger narrative with, like, Dr. Robotnik trying to get all the Chaos Emeralds and, like, him using them to power his machines and stuff, and eventually you get them and become super at the end, it's like a big sort of story moment. I think they execute that stuff well. And I think that, like, legitimately the Sonic levels in both Sonic Adventure 1 and 2 are really well designed and a huge amount of fun to just run around. And I think, like, the homing attack mechanic was well done, like, was a good idea and, like, gives a good sense of speed. And all that stuff is great. Like, I love those levels in those games. And, like, in Sonic Adventure 2, the Robotnik and Tails missions are, like, kind of whatever. They're not terrible. I also don't think they're great.
Some of them I really like. I agree that some of them are kind of meh. There's the Robotnik's one in the desert where he's getting to the pyramid. I like that one.
Sure.
And Tails has the city one that I really like. It's got a great piece of music on it. And I think it's just cool and atmospheric, and I like that.
Yeah. But it is a little bit frustrating when, even with, like, the best Tails and Robotnik sort of, like, mech missions, like, they are way less fun than the Sonic and Shadow missions, which, like, are across the board the best parts of those games. Like, and also in Sonic Adventure 1, the Sonic missions are definitely the best part. Although I hold a love in my heart for the weird Big the Cat fishing missions in Sonic Adventure 1. Just the gall to just straight up force players to play a fucking fishing minigame, like, multiple times to get through to, like, get the true ending of the game.
Absolutely. I mean, as someone who has Sega Bass Fishing downloaded on his Xbox One, those games tickle my heart.
Yeah. So, like, those parts I like. But for me, the star of the Sonic Adventure games, particularly 2, is without a doubt the Chao Garden. I don't know. Did you ever get into the Chao Garden stuff at all?
Oh, yeah. I at one point, we did have a Dreamcast later, like, after we'd already had the GameCube. I don't remember why. But I did have it on my VMU, and it was fun.
Yeah. I mean, in Sonic Adventure 2, there was, like, in like, unsettling amount of depth to the Chao Garden stuff.
No, I did not get super into it, but my brother, oh my god, he had it down to a fucking science. He spent hours in the Chao Garden.
Yeah, I mean, and I had, a bunch of friends that were also, like, way into Sonic Adventure 2. And it was, like, you know, playing the game was fun. But, like, what we really got into, and some of them, like, got into it a little bit more than I did, but was, like, the Chao Garden shit, where it was, like, when you could unlock, like, the heaven room and the hell room and, like, training all your Chows and, like, getting different kinds of Chows and, like, giving them weird hats and buying all the items and stuff. Like, that aspect of those games is, like, you do not have to touch it at all if you don't want to. Like, it is something that is, like, 100% skippable. But they put so much weird work into this weird Chao thing, and it is really fucking awesome. It's a great thing. I wish they would just release a Chow game.
I absolutely agree. And it's awesome. It's also weird and creepy. Because you have this stuff where, like, you can get your Chows to heaven or to fucking hell. And to do that, you have to, you have to abuse them. You have to physically abuse your Chow.
To sort of to make them sort of be imbued with negative emotion. So that the way they can be reborn as, like, demon Chow. And that's awesome.
Yes.
You're right. It's insanely creepy. And there's, like, something weird about, like, going into this Chow garden and just walking up to a Chow and, like, either, like, beating the shit out of it or just, like, petting it on the head over and over and over again to sort of, like, get it to eventually turn white.
My brother and I quote the Chow garden pet lines all the time. Yeah. We go, yosh. Yeah. Or, don't worry. What's Tail say?
I can't remember.
No, I know this because I say it all the time. Why am I forgetting it now? It's like, don't be scared or something like that.
Yes, don't be scared. That is 100% what it is. And, like, another thing that's, like,
I say that to my dog when I pet her sometimes. Yeah,
like, a minor aspect of the Chow Garden in the Sonic Adventure 2, but one that I really liked, was that you could go in as Tails or Robotnik and then play as them outside of their mech things.
Yep. And Tails could fly.
Yeah, and Tails could fly. And, like, that was, as someone who's, like, I played the, like, Sonic the Hedgehog 2 and Sonic the Hedgehog 3. I really wanted I wanted a playable Tails character that could fly and have that stuff. And there was, like, elements of that in Sonic Adventure 1. But, like, yeah, I just think the Chow Garden stuff is so awesome.
Yeah.
For people who maybe never got into that scene, that sounds like it's, like, an ironic thing or something. But legitimately, the Chow Garden stuff in Sonic Adventure 2 is really well designed.
Absolutely. It's to the point where it's almost intimidating to ever think of going back and playing that game again, because the amount of work you would have done on your Chow Garden is, like, irreplaceable.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah.
So anyways, I've pulled up the lyrics for Aquatic Mind.
Let's do it. Sean reading lyrics on this podcast has become a recurring segment.
Yeah. Well, it's only when something really special comes up, and I think the Knuckles rap lyrics are really special. So here we go. Everybody flow with me. This is your boy, Knuckles, and this is the Aquatic Mine. All capitalized. Come on, y'all. Let's take a dive in Aquatic Mine. Once was a coal pit, but now it's a water ride. Makes you want to sit back, enjoy the life, and do things you like doing. Get to shine. It sure beats fighting with them foes all the time, but I gotta do it. They always stay out of line. Sometimes I want to just chill and lamp. It's like, that's not a fucking... That's not even, like, some sort of weird, like, hip term or something. Nobody's ever said that. I want to just chill and lamp. But I'm the protector of the emeralds and gems. I stay knuckled up. I'm in a deep cut. I'm seeing skulls that burn. They trying to throw me off. Avoiding my luck, I'm feeling kind of stuck. I'm in narrow hallways running like it's a ball game. Hand tracks be tracking me to different doorways. In a maze and I don't know what to do. Guaranteed, though, I'm a find the emeralds. Don't call me Knuckles for nothing. I can't lose. Sure beats fighting with them foes all the time, but I gotta do it. They always stay out of line. Sometimes I wanna just chill and lamp, but I'm the protector of the emeralds and gems. I stay knuckled up. I'm in a deep cut. I'm seeing skulls that burn. They trying to cut me off. Avoiding my luck. I'm feeling kinda stuck. Don't call me Knuckles. Give me the bucks.
Did you make that last
line? No! That is the last line.
Oh my god.
Of the rap. Like, let's go back and decompress some of this stuff, because it is fucking amazing.
They do the lamp line twice.
Twice. They go back to that twice. They do it in the refrain, yes. But, like, let's go back to some of these lines. Avoiding my luck, I'm feeling kind of stuck. Going back to my theory that this guy just wrote these lyrics while playing the level of the game... That is 100% what I would write. Like, I'm in the middle of this aquatic mine level. I have no fucking idea where to go. I'm feeling kind of stuck. I'm in narrow hallways running. Like, yes, absolutely. There are lots of weird narrow hallways where you're running around and you have no idea what to do. Hand tracks be tracking me to different doorways in a maze and I don't know what to do. Like, this is just, like, secretly a deep criticism of the level design in Aquatic Mine hidden in a just god-awful rap song.
And again, that one really sounds like he wants to drop a motherfucker in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, there you go. I think that sums up my feeling on Sonic Adventure 2.
Okay. No, Sonic Adventure 1, 2, love them, even though they're flawed. Love warts and all. But, Let's move on. Sonic Heroes, good, not great.
Yeah, whatever.
Sonic the Hedgehog, did you ever play that? Or Shadow the Hedgehog?
Oh, no, no. God,
My brother did. He beat it, like, twice. He didn't really like it, but he played it.
I mean, I know it.
It
has, like, a bunch of different, like, endings and stuff. At one point, I watched all the endings on YouTube.
Oh, they're hilarious. I forgot them all. They're so crazy. I mean, there's some really fucking dark ones.
Yeah. I mean, but anyway. Shadow, he's an edgy character. It's a mature game. Indeed. It's T for team, but...
No, not very good. But we gotta talk about the real shit show here, because basically Sonic was just kind of in the wilderness for a few years, not making really bad games, just not great ones either. And I think everyone thought, well, they'll get back to it, right?
Yeah, and I mean, then, you know, it's a new console generation, 2006.
2006, we have a new one coming out just called Sonic the Hedgehog. It's the 15th anniversary game. So this is 5 years after Sonic Adventure 2, which was the 10th anniversary game. So I think we all had pretty high hopes for this one, right, Sean?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I really liked Sonic Adventure 2 a lot.
Yeah. So Sonic 06.
Mm-hmm.
Still the worst game we've ever played? Is that our have we said that before?
I mean, I've said that before.
Yeah.
I will say it again. Yes.
And I don't know if I can say that because I barely got into it because
I beat
so
it.
You beat it?
I beat it.
How?
I don't know.
That game.
I don't know why I did it. I don't know how I did it, but I fucking beat it.
Oh my god. Sonic 06 is without a doubt the most broken piece of shit game I've ever encountered on a console. I can't believe there weren't major lawsuits because that game was so clearly just broken and unfinished.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really bad.
Like, people talk about, you know, early generation games, they can be messy and stuff. Doesn't hold a candle to Sonic 06.
No, because also it came out a year after the Xbox 360 launched. It was not a launch title. And even if it was a launch title, it would have been inexcusable. But, like, I mean, there's, like, hundreds of, like, weird technical glitches of just, like, oh, my homing attack thing is just not hitting anything anymore. Or I'm just falling through the floor over and over again. Oh, no. It's just, like, awful. And, but you encounter those glitches in games. They're just way more prevalent in 2006. The thing that galls me, that galled everyone that played that game, that is legendary about Sonic 2006, are the motherfucking load times, which are just ridiculous. Especially for a game on the fucking Xbox 360.
And I think people who didn't play this, or maybe are a little younger than us or something, hear about the Sonic 06 load times and are like, eh, games have load times sometimes. What are you talking about? I don't think they understand how bad it was.
Yeah.
It's literally like you would go from one screen in your little hub world to the next, have 2 minutes of loading time.
Yeah.
Not like 1 minute, like 2 minutes sometimes.
Yeah.
You'd go up and talk to someone. Before the dialogue box would come up, it would load. If you want to go to one of the levels, oh, fuck, you're going to have to load a lot to get there. It's like every action you would do in the game was accompanied by an interminably long loading screen.
Well, I mean, I will just go through, like, the classic scenario, which was... Okay, so the structure for Sonic 2006 is, like, nominally similar to the first Sonic Adventure, where there's an open world, like, hub thing... And then you go and do linear missions that branch off of the hub. But when you're in the hub, you can take side missions. And actually, some of them you have to do. Like, some of them are optional to just get, like, power-ups or whatever. Some of the side missions you have to do to progress in the game. And so to do these side missions, you, like, one, you load into the hub world. Like, let's just say all these loads are about a minute long. Because basically every single load in the game is about as long as all of them. And, like... Whether it can, sometimes it'll be like, oh, this is like a 2 minute load, this is a 1 minute load. But the loading time has nothing to do with the amount that it is loading. Like, it just feels like the game somehow is like trying to load the entire game into RAM at the same time every time you load up anything. It's ridiculous.
Right. And I want to stress something else. When we say a minute to load, we're literally saying at least 60 seconds. And I think a lot of people, if we say a minute to load, they're like, that doesn't sound that long. You've probably never played a game with minute long load times.
Yeah, no, like go to a game that you think is like, this game has a really long load and like actually time it. Most games that like where you feel like, this is a long loading screen. It's like a 30-second load. It's a long loading time.
Yeah.
Like, a minute, like, an actual minute is ridiculous. To be sitting there, like, just doing nothing. It sounds ridiculous to, like, on the outside, where you're like, oh, a minute, that's nothing. But, like, you know, your perception of time is completely relative. And there is nothing more long than, like, playing a game and being actively, like controlling it. And then hitting a black screen with, like, a little circle spinning in the corner and just having to sit there and stare at it, your perception of time lengthens quite a bit in that scenario. So anyway, so yes, that's the length of the loads is basically literally 60 seconds. So you do the 60-second load, you get into the hub city, you see like, oh, I have to go do this side mission to progress further. I'll go run over there, you run over there, you talk to the dude. But when you go up to talk to the dude, you hit A on him and it does a 60-second load. And then when it comes up, It is a dialogue. And it's like a dialogue box opens up and the guy says, oh, hey, Sonic, you need to collect 50 rings. And then you hit, okay. And then it goes into another 60-second load. So you have been playing, like, actively playing the game for about 2 minutes, but have hit, like, 3 minutes worth of loading screens before you've actually done any, like, the thing that you're trying to do. Then you get into the mission. It is, like, a 30-second long fucking bullshit little side mission. Like, all the side missions are super quick in that game. You, like, finish that side mission in, like, what is would literally be shorter than the load time to get into it. Shorter than the load time to get into the dialogue box to get into it. So then you beat the mission. It does a minute-long load to another dialogue box screen where the guy says, good job, Sonic. Now you can go over here. And then you hit OK. And then it does a another minute-long load screen to get back into the open world. You have to do 5 to 6 load screens that are each about a minute long to do one tiny fucking side mission. It's unbelievable. It is unfucking believable. No other game I have ever played in my entire life has done anything even close to that. It is insane.
Yeah.
Like, imagine if Gravity Rush had that. Imagine if you're playing Gravity Rush and you go do one of, like, the little, like, race side missions that is like, oh, you finish this race in 40 seconds and you can, like, you get a gold medal on it. And it's like, you have to run up to the thing, and it's like, in actual Gravity Rush, there's, like, a tiny, like, 5-second load when you actually activate it, and then you just can do the race over and over again, and if you fail and want to retry it, it's another tiny 5-second load. Imagine if instead, it was like walking up to the thing, you then had to load into a dialogue box, and then you, like, when it told you, like, oh, you, this is a sliding race, and then you press X, and then it did another load to go to the exact same spot. The only thing that's different is that the dialogue box is now gone. It would be intolerable.
It would be, for me, and this is why I never got, honestly, I never even got past the first level in Sonic 06. Because it takes you forever to get to the first level.
Yeah.
And then once you do, it's awful, and then I was out. And part of that is that I've had all my life, and it's gotten worse as I've gotten older, but I do have ADHD tendencies. I don't know if I am ADHD. I have not gotten, like, officially diagnosed by a doctor, but I am 99% sure I am. And so it's actually something why the older I get, the more I like video games, because it's very easy for me to concentrate on a game more than it is like a movie or something, which I know sounds weird because everyone knows me as the movie guy.
Yeah.
But that's a weird thing with me. And so with loading screens, that's always been a tough thing for me to deal with, is loading screens. But overall, you get used to it because they're not egregious, right?
You know? Or like a game, because usually it's like if a game has a really long load, it's like Grand Theft Auto 5, and there's like a minute long load at the top.
Yes.
And then once you're in, it never has to load again.
Exactly. And so I know how to cope with those. Sonic 06, and this was a long time ago. This was not as bad for me then. I have more like an adult onset thing. But like, so, you know, 10 years ago when this came out, this is literally a 10-year-old game now.
Yes, it is.
Anyway, like, I literally could not deal with it. Like, the loading screens were so bad, I just get fidgety and uncomfortable, and it is physically unplayable for me.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't happen. No. In a Sonic game. Like, Sonic should be perfect for people with ADD.
Yeah, it's your running really fast and, like, hitting, jumping on enemies and getting rings, and it goes bing, bing, bing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it is not a, oh, I'm going to walk around this open hub world and, like, hit 5 minutes worth of different loading screens all the time.
God.
Yeah. And then, so, like, that's the most atrocious thing about it. But then, like, all across the board, like, the story is completely awful. This is when they, like, switched all the voice actors over to the Sonic X voice actors. Like, there's again, it's like an infamous storyline about Sonic's, like, romance with Princess Elise, who is a human person, just straight up, like, and, like, there are some, like, CG cutscenes where she is, like, a really, like, well-rendered human woman for, like, an early Xbox 360 game that it looks like it's fucking, like, a Final Fantasy X, like, animated cutscene or something. It's like, that's, like, normally, like, just, like, properly proportioned, like, not cartoonified or anything at all. Just a human woman straight up making out with, like, a 3-foot-tall anthropomorphized ridiculous cartoon hedgehog named Sonic. Like, that is something you shouldn't put in your game. That is not something you should ever do. Even, like, the weird furry, like, fan base for Sonic the Hedgehog at least ships him with other anthropomorphized cartoon characters and not normal human people, right?
Yes.
Like, they're not even weird enough to do that. Like, I can't, like, I still can't believe that they fucking did that in Sonic 2006. It's just insane.
I mean, there's a bunch of, you know, the Did You Know Gaming series?
Yes, yeah.
They've done a bunch of great Sonic videos, and one of them is on Sonic 06, and one of the things they talked about is that all that Elite stuff was for a different game by Sega,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and just had nothing to do with Sonic, and then they kind of did it together, and then, like, the story behind Sonic 06 is fascinating. I would gladly read a book on it if someone wrote one.
Right, yeah.
Because there's a bunch of stuff like, they were actually going along pretty well with the development, and then in the last year of development, they were going to be putting it out on Wii also. They realized the Wii could not do the graphics for Sonic 06, and so instead of hiring more people, Sega made them split the team, and so the team that was working on Sonic 06 had to go work on Sonic and the Secret Rings, and so both games are shit because they had literally half staff for what were two very ambitious games.
Yeah.
So it's like, I feel really bad for the people who worked on it, because I'm sure they're all talented, and I think there are probably glimmers in Sonic 06 of things that could have been.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's why I finished the game, was like, because like, there are moments when the game did work where it was like, it was never as good as like the best parts of Sonic Adventure 2 or anything like that, but like, there were moments where it was like, this kind of feels like I'm playing a Sonic Adventure game. Like,
right.
Where the lock-on stuff is all working, and like, I'm not falling through the floor, and I kind of, like, the Princess Elise stuff hasn't come up in a while, and I'm just running through this level that looks pretty good as Sonic the Hedgehog, and it's like, I'm having a fun time. Like, that would happen every now and then.
And like, the levels from that game that were in Sonic Generations are kind of fun when you get them in a worthwhile game, you know?
Yeah, but then also, that, like, Sonic 2006 was really sort of like, pulled down by the Shadow the Hedgehog and Silver the Hedgehog sections, which were really bad, because like, they pulled in some of that, like, Shadow like has like weapons and guns and is shooting enemy stuff from Shadow the Hedgehog, and Silver had like telepathic powers or some telekinetic powers. It was like, that stuff was bad. The story was like, this is not to say that like, the stories in Sonic Adventure 1 and 2 were like amazing and like totally like really sort of like fully comprehensible and like logical plots, but like, there was something to them. In Sonic 2006, it just felt like, especially if you had played Sonic Adventure 1 and 2, it just, like, threw so much weird stuff out the window, but then kept weird stuff. So it was like, you had no idea where Shadow the Hedgehog was at anymore as a character. Or, like, when Rouge the Bat showed up, you're like, why are you doing any of the stuff that you're doing? Like, there was no logical connection from, like, the characters in the previous games and this one. And the plot had all this crazy time travel shit that just, like, was not needed and stuff like that. It's a bad game. It's just a really bad game across the board. It's,
yeah.
And it was like, it's, again, to this day, is the worst game I've played. And it's important to, like, say sometimes, because it's easy to forget that it's like, just because it's a bad game does not mean that, like, bad people worked on it or anything like that. Like, video games are astoundingly hard to make. They're like, I am continually just astonished that anyone can make any video game of any description at all. Especially when you look at something like Doom or Uncharted 4 that is that like technically complicated, and they're able to pull it off, and it is seamless and just a complete masterpiece. Like, games are like way more than something like a movie. Like, games are insanely hard to make, and it's like, it is hard to sort of express that in any way when you're talking about them. But like do any sort of reading on like behind the scenes stuff on how games are made, or like, if you have, like, for me, it was a lot of like watching the documentaries on Halo 2 Special Edition, or the God of War games are very good, having behind the scenes featurettes, and you see how much these people completely kill themselves to just get a like weird prototype on a single mechanic working, like, let alone put the whole thing together.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, like, just because Sonic the Hedgehog 2006 is the worst game I've played doesn't mean that, like, I don't respect the people that tried to make it, because they just got fucked by circumstances.
Well, and they agree with you that it's terrible. So yeah, they have come out against it and said, yeah, we got really fucked on that one.
Yeah.
So anyway, Sonic and the Secret Rings. I got to talk about that.
Okay, because Sonic 2006 is more or less where I jumped off.
Okay.
And, like, I didn't play any of the Wii games or anything like that.
Well, I can talk about a lot of these, but let me talk about Sonic and the Secret Rings, because this is the one I probably got the deepest into of that era. Sonic and the Secret Rings is the Wii one, and the first thing I'll say is, it was for the time, I don't know if I went back to it I would feel this way, it was a really gorgeous game. Like, it was one of the first games on the Wii that looked kind of next gen over the GameCube, and kind of had really beautiful visuals and stuff. And this, you know, this was back probably on a 720p TV, or maybe actually that one I probably had on my tube TV when I played it. So, because I did not get an HD TV until 2007 or 8. So,
So it was probably on a tube TV.
It was probably on a tube TV. Either way, it looked good. So that's one thing. But it was a really weird game where what they did was, you held the Wiimote sideways, and you didn't really use the buttons, except I think you might have used A or 2 to jump. But other than that, you turn the controller right, left, like you tilted it, like you tilted your body with it. And it was all on rails, and Sonic would run, and you had to turn and tilt him around things. And then, actually, I don't even think you used a button. I think you swiped up to jump. Like,
that
you moved
the
controller to jump, and you have to jump over obstacles. It's not quite as simplified as, like, the Sonic Go games now or something like
that. Yeah, which are just endless runners. Like,
yeah. It wasn't really like that, but it had elements of that. And it could be really interesting at times. Like I said, the graphics and art design were pretty cool, and there were some cool parts. But overall, it was just very frustrating and weird in the way certain early Wii games were.
Yeah.
It was way too gimmicky. And the biggest problem with that game is whenever you died, whenever you finished a level, whenever you started a level, whenever you loaded a fucking screen, it would play the same snippet of the same song, the Secret Ring song, and the band Crush 40, which did a lot of the Sonic's music for the adventure games in that era, they later put out the full version of that song, and it's a pretty good song. But like the version that is in that game, it is an intensely obnoxious song, especially the snippet they would play every time. And all I remember is the, like, make the rings burn, got the rings and burn. And they would do that, and it would just, and you would hear it over and over, and I wanted to break everything because it was so obnoxious. And so that is not a game I finished, but I got pretty deep into before realizing it was terrible.
Okay.
So you had that. You had Sonic Unleashed on the Xbox 360,
yeah,
which I never really played myself, but my brother did, and I watched him play some of it. And these, when you're Sonic and you're running, some parts of that game are incredibly impressive.
Yeah.
When you are a Werehog, it's like the worst God of War ripoff ever made.
Yeah, it's like, I remember playing the Xbox 360 demo for that game, and like, there's a Werehog section at the end of the demo. I was like, okay, I'm out. This is awful.
Yeah,
Werehog
it was awful.
Stuff. Like, just conceptually, it was a terrible idea. Like, that's just fucking, like, even the Archie comic series wouldn't have come up with something like that in, like, their darkest hour. Like, it's just such a weird, desperate pull to make, like, Sonic a Werehog. Like, what?
So there's that. Let's see. Sonic and the Black Knight, never played. We never owned that one. Thomas finally stopped playing Sonic.
Because that was basically the sequel to the Wii one, the Green
one. And I should say, during this period, there were a bunch of really good handheld ones. Sonic Advance 1, 2, and 3 are all very good traditional games. Sonic games. And some of the DS ones, I never played those ones, but I know them to be good. Like, people liked things
the
like
Sonic Rush games.
Yeah, people liked some of those. So, kind of like, honestly, Zelda sometimes, where Zelda has console games that a lot of people love, but a lot of people, like you, are more meh on.
Yeah.
The handheld ones have gotten pretty universal good reception. So, Sonic was kind of the same way, although Sonic has not had a real handheld game in a long time.
Yeah.
So, anyway, then there was the Wii game Sonic Colors, and I've played some of Sonic Colors. My brother played the whole thing, and that is a cult favorite. A lot of people will say Sonic Colors is, after Sonic Adventure 2, the closest Sonic has ever come to being really good. Generations kind of being its own things. It's kind of a remake in some ways.
Yeah.
But Sonic Colors is an original game. A lot of people really love that one. It's kind of got this like world level structure like Mario World or something, and the levels are pretty good. And I saw someone say this the other day online, and I think it's true. If that would be a good one for them to like make an HD remake of and put out so everyone could play it, because that one probably was ill-served by being on the Wii. It did not have any like of the gimmick stuff, but it just was kind of limited in who played it. And
it was also because it was like a kind of late game on the Wii as well. So.
And I think it was probably a little more ambitious than the Wii could handle. But I do think there's a good game in there. So that is one of the brighter spots of Sonic.
Well, and like the 3D stuff in Sonic Colors, even though I didn't play it, I know that like that is the framework that they used to move on for Sonic Generations stuff. And like, so, that stuff worked really well.
Yeah. But then we were all back for 2011, Sonic Generations. It was on both of our top 10s that year.
Yes, it was.
And it was such a pleasure.
It's a really good game.
I mean, it was literally the first time in 10 years, because 2001 is Sonic Adventure 2.
Yeah.
And this was the 20th anniversary game with Sonic Generations, that it feel like top to bottom we had a Sonic game that we were enjoying.
Yeah, and it's like, and I just don't know how Sonic Generations got made. Like, because it's like, there was no Sonic game like it before it, and there has been no Sonic game since, even though it's been now 5 years since it came out, which is like
sad.
More than enough time if they had ever been inclined to make a sequel, Sonic Generations 2, or a new Sonic game that had a lot of the mechanics and the framing and stuff of Sonic Generations. Instead, they just rebooted it into Sonic Boom. But Sonic Generations, like, you know, it was their anniversary game. It was them going and like having this like crazy time travel story where 3D Sonic and 2D Sonic meet, and like the 3D and 2D versions of the different games, like other characters, get to meet and sort of come together. And the whole structure of the game was that you would have this sort of like best of album, kind of the different Sonic games throughout the history, and there's kind of more or less one Sonic level from each of the very notable games, and there would be a classic version of the level and a modern version of the level. So, like, the first level's the Green Hill Zone, obviously, and the classic version is just, like, a sort of 2D remix version of the Green Hill Zone level with, like, obviously, like, 3D graphics but a 2D perspective. And then you would have the modern version, which would have you being, like, kind of behind-the-back 3D Sonic on a track, more or less, like, running, like, with boost powers and sliding powers and stuff to overcome obstacles. And then every once in a while, it would shift into, like, a 2D thing in the modern levels. And that was more or less how the game was structured. And I think that sense of, one, of pacing, of having, like, traditional 2D levels mixed with these, like, sort of crazy high-speed, like, on-rails 3D race kind of track levels really helped the game to sort of be like, okay, like, if it was just a series of these racetrack levels, I think I would get kind of bored of it, of playing them one after the other. But having the more slower-paced 2D levels interspersed with going on, like, these really, like, high-adrenaline, like, racing levels, that worked really well. And it still just galls me to this day that they never used that concept for further Sonic games, because I think it solved kind of, in a way, it didn't necessarily solve the 3D Sonic problem, but it sidestepped it in a way. Whereas, like, we can have the 2D Sonic stuff and the 3D Sonic stuff in the same game, and it can work fine. There's no reason why it has to be just one or the other.
And it was a really cool turn in that game where early on, the 2D levels are what you remember, and then the 3D are these new explorations. But when you get to the 3D games, the 3D ones are like remakes of what you remember, but then they come up with 2D versions of those.
Yeah, like the 2D version of like Cityscape and stuff like that.
Which was almost even cooler to kind of see them reimagine what was kind of a reimagining to begin with.
Yeah.
So all of that was really neat. Yeah, it's a very well-paced game. It's short, but in the best way possible. The only thing I remember is I hate the last boss. But
the last boss is atrocious, but like that is the only part of that game I really disliked.
Yeah, the rest of it is really cool.
Because a lot of the boss fights are actually really fun up until the last boss. But then also, like, it's just chock full of really amazing fan service. Because there's a bunch of different, like, little challenge missions you can do as well, and those are fun. But then the most important thing was, like, doing all the challenge missions and all that stuff unlocked different pieces of music, and they just had this incredible selection of pieces of music throughout the history of Sonic, which has always had great music, along with all their, like, classic and modern remixed versions of the different themes. It was like, and you could go into different levels if you're trying to get, like, a particular time or something on one of the levels. You could go in, and you could play Super Sonic Racing from Sonic R if you wanted, or you could play, like, that one really good song from Sonic 3D Blast or something like that. Like, there's just this insane level. I think there's music from, like, Sonic Spinball and shit like that. But that's just, like, as a huge Sonic fan for, like, my entire life, going back to, like, the early games, that was so rewarding for me. It's just, like, being able to, oh, yeah, like, this music is awesome. And, like, these versions of these, of, like, Sky Sanctuary from Sonic and Knuckles and stuff. Like, that's awesome to see that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sonic Generations is great. I think it still holds up even 5 years later, because I played a little bit of it a couple of days ago.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a great game. And that was the end of that. Because
that was this last Sonic the Hedgehog game I've played.
And by the way, we forgot in that whole middle period, Sonic the Hedgehog 4.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a reason why.
It's this super weird... Sean did talk about this on the podcast at some point, but it would have been a really long time ago.
Yeah.
But basically, your conclusion was, it was billed as a new Sonic game.
It was billed as Sonic the Hedgehog 4.
Right.
The sequel to Sonic the Hedgehog 3, which is Sonic and Knuckles, but you know.
Whatever.
You know.
Yeah. But anyway...
And it was an episodic game as well, because it's Sonic the Hedgehog 4 Episode 1. They did make an Episode 2. They have not made an Episode 3.
No. Just like Half-Life.
Yeah.
No. But anyway... And so even though it was billed as something new, it was really remakes of old levels and bosses.
I mean, basically. I mean, not all of it was remakes of stuff. The problem with Sonic the Hedgehog 4, Episode 1 at the very least, was that, one, the movement was bad. So it's like already you're done. Like, the way that Sonic would come to a dead stop was just awful. Like, it is hard to describe how just, like, disgusting it feels when you're someone that's, like, really used to playing those old 2D Sonic games. Because also, when Sonic the Hedgehog 4 came out, was after all those games had been re-released on the Xbox Live Arcade. So I had already very recently played through Sonic the Hedgehog 1, 2, 3, and then Sonic 3 and Knuckles. This wasn't quite when CD came out, so I hadn't gotten to that one yet. But it was like, I was very much used to the old Sonic the Hedgehog games, and then switching to this one that, like, the movement was just sticky. It was gross, and it was like, why? And then there were a bunch of sections in the middle of levels where they would have, like, puzzles. It's like, where you had to stop and, like, push boxes and shit like that. It's like, this is not... Like, I'm not saying, like, everything in, like, this game has to be, like it's slaved to the old, like, original Genesis games. But, like, don't add a weird puzzle section in the middle of a 2D Sonic level. Like, that's just... Who thought of that? But the worst part of it was when I got to the end and it was, like... The last boss for Sonic the Hedgehog 4, Episode 1, is literally the last boss of Sonic the Hedgehog 2. It is the exact same boss with the exact same patterns, the exact same visual design. I think even the exact same music. They just use the last boss from Sonic the Hedgehog 2. It's just like, it's fine in Sonic Generations when you fight the last boss from Sonic the Hedgehog 2 because that's like a remix game. Like, that's okay. You should not just rip off the fucking last boss for Sonic the Hedgehog 2 at the end of Sonic the Hedgehog 4 as if nobody would fucking notice.
Yes, I mean, it's funny because I think the impetus for Sonic the Hedgehog 4 was a couple years earlier, New Super Mario Bros. Had come out for the DS.
Yeah.
And I think people forget this. That is the highest-selling DS game,
yeah.
Which makes it one of the highest-selling games, period, ever made. And I think it's one of the best games Nintendo as a company has ever released. It is a phenomenal game. Where you're putting Mario back in 2D, but with 3D graphics, but with a new game that is not a remake, but takes inspiration from. And I think they wanted to do that with Sonic 4, and they just didn't know what they were doing. They had no idea.
No.
And especially up against that Mario game, it was so incompetent.
Yeah.
Because I played the demo is what I played, and it was so awful, I just never played more.
Yeah, not good. Never went back for Episode 2. I heard that they fixed some of the movement stuff in Sonic the Hedgehog 4 Episode 2, but it's too late. It was too late.
Yeah, whatever.
And then they put Tails in it also.
All right. Well, you want to give us your list, Sean?
Okay, yes. Yeah. So that is, Sonic the Hedgehog 4 and Sonic Generations were the two last Sonic games that either of us have played, because neither of us have taken the dark dive into Sonic Boom and what they did with the character.
Oh, did we forget to talk about the Sonic Mario Party ripoff on the Dreamcast? Sonic, what's it called?
Sonic Shuffle?
Yeah, Sonic Shuffle.
I mean, there are lots of Sonic spin-off games that have happened over the years.
Sonic Shuffle was really bad, so I wanted to... I have played it.
I have not played Sonic Shuffle.
Sonic Shuffle is not good.
Okay. I will take your word for it, and I will avoid playing... As someone who doesn't even like Mario Party anymore, going back to it, I'm definitely not going to play a bad Mario Party ripoff.
Yeah.
So, there have been lots of spin-off Sonic games, and I have made a list here... of all the Sonic the Hedgehog games or Sonic the Hedgehog affiliated games I have ever played, but I have not put Sonic Unleashed on here, even though I played the demo because I think the demo doesn't count. But these are all games that I either rented or bought or played at a friend's house for some reasonable amount of time. So it's like this is not I have beaten all these games. Far from it. I probably have beaten most of these games, but there are definitely some of them on here that I very much did not actually finish. So, this is my ranking order of the 17 Sonic the Hedgehog games I have played. So, number 17 is Sonic the Hedgehog 2006, or I have it here in the appropriate way to write it, which is Sonic the Hedgehog in all capitals, because that is how it is, that is its official trademarked title, is Sonic the Hedgehog completely capitalized. We talked about that game. That game is fucking awful. Fuck that game. It's not just the worst Sonic the Hedgehog game I've played, it is the worst game I've played. So, it is definitely at the bottom of this list. Number 16 is Sonic the Hedgehog 4, Episode 1. The balls to be just talking about that. Fuck that game, too. Number 15 is Sonic Spinball, the Sega Genesis game, which is a Sonic the Hedgehog pinball game, which I never owned, but I rented once, and I didn't like it very much. I can't say anything very specific about it. It is basically a pinball game where you play as Sonic the Hedgehog.
I think there's a pinball section in Sonic Adventure 1 that is better than Sonic Spinball.
Yes, there's the casino level, the traditional casino level in Sonic Adventure 1. That is, yes, it is. You're right, it's better than Sonic Spinball. Number 14 is a game I own on the Sega Genesis, Sonic 3D Blast.
You own that?
Yes, it is over there somewhere. It's on that cabinet over there.
I'm going to have to take a look at that. That's
so it's Sonic 3D Blast. It was a very, very late Sega Genesis game. And we bought it for super cheap because we bought it at a Blockbuster that was going out of business in the mid-90s.
That was the best time to buy games.
Yeah, so they had a clearance sale, and then we were there, and I was like, so there's a fucking Blockbuster sticker still on the back of that is just welded onto the back of that cartridge, because I tried to get it off multiple times. It's like, I don't want a Blockbuster sticker on my game. But Sonic 3D Blast is a bad game. It is sort of slow and meandering. It is it's a weird sort of isometric perspective, and it was because I was playing it earlier today to remind myself of it when I plugged in my Sega Genesis, and it's you have to defeat all these enemies to get the flickies, which are these little birds, And then you have to, like, you, like, get all the flickies in a different area and bring them to a portal. And then they go into the portal, and then you can move to the next section of the level. It's not very good.
I have played Sonic 3D Blast because it's one of those games that's on every collection.
Yeah, like every Genesis Mega Collection kind of thing.
I've always forgotten. I never knew that was a Genesis game, though. I assumed it was from one of their shitty other consoles.
I think it also came out on the PC and the Sega Saturn, but it was a, like, 1995 Sega Genesis game.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, very late Genesis game, and it is not very good. Though it was made by Traveler's Tales, which you may know as the people who make the Lego games.
Wow.
It is one of the first games they ever made.
They got better.
Yeah. Then there is another Sonic game coming up later that Traveler Tales also made that you might be surprised at.
Lego Sonic?
No. That would be really crazy if that came back around.
It would probably be better than most recent Sonic games.
You were right. It probably would be. So that's Sonic 3D Blast. The music in Sonic 3D Blast is legitimately pretty good. Also, speaking of games that ripped out elements from other Sonic the Hedgehog games, or specifically Sonic the Hedgehog 2, Sonic 3D Blast just rips off the Chaos Emerald levels from Sonic the Hedgehog 2, and I thought that was really lazy. So then moving on, my number 13, Knuckles Chaotix.
You played that?
Yes, I only emulated it because I never owned a Sega 32X, but just out of curiosity, several years ago I emulated it. It's not very good. It's a weird... There's a really bizarre mechanic in that game where you are attached to, like, you play as kind of like two characters that are sort of connected by a weird, like, almost magnetic force, and you have to, like, use that to, like, slingshot people. It's a really strange game that's not very Sonic-esque, but it is a Sonic-affiliated game. It has Knuckles in the game. It's him and Charmy the Bee, Vector the Crocodile, and Espio the Chameleon, who are all the characters. They were also in my next game on the list, number 12, Sonic Heroes.
I did play some Sonic Heroes. It was, it was like 2 years ago where I was home from college for a weekend because I had to help my mom with something around the house. Like, she was out of town and I had to wash the house. And I think I forgot to bring home, like, my PlayStation or something, so I didn't have anything to play. So I had my GameCube and I played through a lot of the Heroes section of Sonic Heroes, like the Sonic Tails Knuckles.
Yeah.
And I had fun. There are parts of that game that are really good.
Yeah, but it's like, as a follow-up to Sonic Adventure 2...
Very disappointing.
Yeah, I just remember being really bummed out about that game. And, like, I never bought it. Like, I only rented it. And, like, I remember just kind of playing the first couple of levels of each of the different sides and being like, this is not... I don't know. This isn't very good. So moving on from number 12. Number 11, a game near and dear to my heart, even though it's actually worse than all these other games, but one element of it makes it rise above the chaff. Sonic R, which is a 3D behind-the-back racing game by Traveler's Tales.
They made that.
But the reason that Sonic R sort of stands the test of time, to me at least, is the fact that it has the most incredible fucking mid-90s soundtrack. This game came out in 1997. It has the most insanely amazing soundtrack ever assembled for any video game ever. It is, like, all lyrical music made by a specific band that I might not be able to find their name, but, like, the band, like, it is all lyrical music, and it's, like, every level has a different song associated with it. It is all the most cheesy, awful 90s music possible, except for Supersonic Racing, which is a song I legitimately really like.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on Supersonic Racing, Jonathan?
It's a great song. We were talking about this before the podcast. Sonic R probably has the historical distinction of being the worst game with the best soundtrack.
Yeah, it's really, the actual gameplay of Sonic R is pretty awful. And just to sum this up, when I was looking up some of this stuff earlier today, I was on the Wikipedia page for Sonic R, and at the bottom of the reception section is a quote I just adore. This is from game designer Hirokazu Yasuhara, who helped Traveler's Tales rework the game in response to concerns over the quality of a preview version. He has maintained that, quote, "The final version of Sonic R is actually quite good. However, I do admit that the base concept of Sonic R, in which a player drives running characters, is not great." I just love that you had a dude who, like, from Sega, a game developer, is quoted as saying, the concept of that game isn't great. Like, that's just, like, so straight. That's like, yeah, and it's... That is also the game, I feel like that is the first appearance of, Puppet Tails, which is, like, the Tails version of Mecha Sonic that is absolutely terrifying.
But oh yeah, jeez, yeah. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, okay. It has made very rare appearances, but yeah, Sonic R is a very strange game in the history of the Sonic franchise. But yes. Do yourself a favor and look up that soundtrack on YouTube because it is fucking amazing. Number 10, Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine.
That game's okay.
That game is okay. It is an okay puzzle game.
Yeah.
Moving on. It is on the Sega Genesis. That's all, really. Number 9, Sonic Advance 1. The Sonic Advance game, on the first Sonic Advance game on the Game Boy Advance. It is a sort of very traditional 2D Sonic the Hedgehog game. I don't remember that much about Sonic Advance 1. I remember that it is one of like 5 Game Boy Advance games I had that were stolen when I was at a basketball game with my brothers and I was in the audience and I had like a pouch that was just full of different Game Boy Advance games and someone stole them.
Motherfucker.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like that, like a Spider-Man game I had and some other ones. And so, yeah. I've never played Sonic Advance 1 since.
I replayed it a couple years ago. It's pretty good.
Yeah. I remember you have to refight like the first boss from Sonic the Hedgehog 1 at the very end.
Yeah.
Where he swings the thing. Yeah.
It is totally okay.
Yeah, it's a decent 2D Sonic game. Number 8 is Sonic Adventure 1. We talked a lot about Sonic Adventure 1 already. It's a good game. Decent, transitionary period to try to get it into 3D. I like the story stuff a lot in Sonic Adventure 1. Number 7 is Sonic Advance 2, which I think is a fairly traditional 2D Sonic game on the Game Boy Advance, but it's much better than Sonic Advance 1. They have a lot of different playable characters like Knuckles and Tails and Amy and Sonic, and they all play very differently. And I remember the animation in that game looks really good for a Game Boy Advance
game. Oh, yeah. Sonic Advance 2 is great.
Yeah. So Sonic Advance 2, that's like a game that if like you really like 2D Sonic games and you've never played any of the Advance ones, like pick up Sonic Advance 2. And I've never played Sonic Advance 3. Have you played the third one?
Yes, I have not played it to completion. It was kind of more the same of 2. I feel like 1 and 2 are the kind of more memorable ones.
Yeah, yeah. I just never really took the plunge on Advance 3 because I remember that's what sort of the conversation around it. So then number 6 is Sonic Adventure 2. Talked a lot about Sonic Adventure 2. Sonic Adventure 2 is a pretty damn good game. It the thing that put it above Sonic Advance 2 for me, because I like Sonic Advance 2 a lot, I play that game a bunch, is specifically the Chao Garden, just so everyone knows why it is where it is. Number 5 is the original Sonic the Hedgehog. It's a very, very good game, a classic game, but is by far the weakest of those Genesis games. Like, there's just like, you know, there's stuff like there's only 6 Chaos Emeralds, there's no Super Sonic, you can't do the Super Spin Dash from like standing, that stuff like that, where it's like, you know, it's a really good game, but it's kind of unrefined so far. That's number 5. Number 4 is Sonic Generations. Great fucking game. Number 3 is Sonic CD. This is a game I did never played when it came out because I didn't have, nor did I ever know anyone who owned a Sega CD. But when I got the Xbox Live Arcade release of it several years ago, Sonic CD is a really fucking good Sonic the Hedgehog game.
With great music.
Great, great music. And it's just like a weird Sonic the Hedgehog game because this whole like sort of like time travel mechanic and stuff like that where you go to the past versions or future versions of the stage and interact with it in different ways. It's just a very interesting, fun game. It is also the first appearance of Amy Rose. It is also and the first appearance of Metal Sonic, which are both characters I like a lot.
Yep.
And it has one of the most amazing animated intros to any game ever. With like that has the American version of it has that Sonic Boom song.
I love it.
That like still to this day, I am just the thing I am most upset with about the Sonic Boom like reboot thing for the franchise is that they took the name from that awesome song from Sonic CD.
Yes.
So that's Sonic CD. And actually, now I'm thinking about Sonic Boom. How I first encountered Sonic CD was by watching that cutscene, which was an unlockable extra on the Xbox original Genesis collection.
Yes.
That's how I found out about the existence of Sonic.
It was on the GameCube collection of the Genesis games as well.
Yeah, that was a port of that version. So yeah, Sonic CD is really good if you can go back and find it. Number 2, Sonic the Hedgehog 2. It's Sonic the Hedgehog 2. It's a really good video game. Like, I don't know if there's much more to say about it. It's got a really good last boss also. Like, yes. I guess people at Sega remembered that. Then my number 1 is... I struggled with this for a long time, how to label these games, but I just went with my number 1 is Sonic 3 and Knuckles. They were originally one game that were eventually split into two because it was too awesome to just be on one cartridge. So instead they just released Sonic the Hedgehog 3, and then a year later they released Sonic and Knuckles, which has, if you've never seen this, it's amazing. Because it's just a Sega Genesis cart that has like a thing on top that you flip it back. And it has another port that is like in the Genesis like receptive port for the cartridge. And you put Sonic the Hedgehog 3 on top of that. So you just have a game on your game in your system. And that is amazing. Sonic and Knuckles, also, if you put Sonic the Hedgehog 2 in it, you can play as Knuckles in Sonic the Hedgehog 2, which is a little weird because that game was not designed around that character. But yeah, Sonic 3 and Knuckles is, you know, I'll talk about it as, like, the first game I really remember playing. I think, like, even then going back to it later when it was released on the Xbox Live Arcade, stands up as the best Sonic game for stuff like the sort of cinematic presentation of the game, like little story moments in the middle of, in between levels, like the way that the first level halfway through Angel Island Zone Act 1 is like this, like, idyllic sort of, like, paradise tropical island that you're in, and then you hit the mid-boss, and then the mid-boss fires all these rockets in the air and, like, lights it all on fire, and in the middle of that weapon, that level just becomes completely different. Or at the end of Angel Island Zone Act 2, where Dr. Robotnik has his big flying, like, airship that comes in and drops bombs and you have to run away from it. Like, there's just bunches of little moments like that peppered throughout Sonic 3 and Sonic and Knuckles that just evokes so much about what is happening, that does so much to sort of create the seamless experience that Sonic the Hedgehog 1 and 2 did not have. And for me, that is, like, the defining trait of Sonic 3 and Knuckles that makes it stand above all the other Sonic the Hedgehog games.
Absolutely.
It's a very good game.
Good list.
Yes. And that is a lot of Sonic the Hedgehog games that I've played.
That is a lot of Sonic the Hedgehog games. So what do we want from the future of Sonic the Hedgehog? They are going to announce in the next few days, I think, the new Sonic the Hedgehog game. I can tell you what my dream game would be.
Okay.
I would like them to just fucking do it. Announce Sonic Adventure 3. You're making it. Have the nostalgia factor of all the people who were kids when Adventure 1 and 2 came out. We're finally making 3.
We got all the voice actors back.
Or just a new cast. I don't care if it's the old, just a new cast that can actually do the parts with reasonable art design, not the Sonic Boom shit. We're going to go pick up where we left off with Sonic Adventure 2. We're going to use some of the design we learned in Sonic Generations and Sonic Colors and things like that. We're going to have a hub world again and something fun like that, but more fleshed out with the stuff you can do on the PS4 and Xbox One. We're going to have levels that are primarily Sonic-based, but maybe we can do stuff with the other characters, find cool ways to integrate them. We're going to have a story that is comprehensible, in which Sonic does not commit bestiality with a human, all of that stuff. And we're going to have fun with it, and we're going to make Sonic Adventure 3 the way it should have been made, but in the year 2016. I want that.
Okay, yeah, that is reasonable. Insane, but reasonable. For me,
they would make money on that. I just want to be clear. If they made a good game called Sonic Adventure 3, that would be a huge hit.
A huge hit might be a stretch, but it would be financially successful, I think. Yes. I would agree with that. For me, my dream Sonic the Hedgehog game is scrap all that Sonic Boom shit. Just, like, sink it all. Just, like, destroy it. And then especially destroy your weird redesign of Knuckles in particular. Because you just ruined who was an awesome character introduced in Sonic the Hedgehog 3. And they just destroyed him ever since. So, like, sink all that stuff. And, like, honestly, I would just do, like, an actual proper, like, reboot of Sonic the Hedgehog. Which is to, like, make it, like get in a really good team. That, like, then, like, you know, like, take some ideas of, like, what worked with Sonic Adventure. What worked with Sonic Generations and stuff. But just, like, carte blanche, like, go back to the beginning, wipe everything. It's Sonic the Hedgehog on a planet. Dr. Robotnik is there, and go back to just calling him Dr. Robotnik, not this Eggman shit. Like, I know that's what he was called in Japan, but Dr. Robotnik is a way better name.
Yes.
And, like, it is Sonic the Hedgehog. Dr. Robotnik is going around turning little animals into robot enemies. Sonic the Hedgehog has to defeat them and free the little animals on his quest to, like, eventually get to a giant, like, robot place. Along the way, he goes through a casino for whatever reason, because he always does that. And eventually he gets to a giant factory where he fights Dr. Robotnik and defeats him. And just make that game in 2016, like, put more story into it, like, obviously flesh it out, like, make 3D mechanics. Like, I think I wish the Sonic the Hedgehog games would go back and try to rethink combat in some way and do something more interesting with combat in a 3D Sonic game that they've, like, never really, like, progressed past that kind of homing attack stuff that was in the Sonic Adventure games, and do that, and then you make Sonic the Hedgehog 2 or whatever, however you want to title these games, and then you put Tails in and make Tails a playable character in that, and then you, like, just do that, and, like, you can even, like, remake the story of Sonic the Hedgehog 2 with, like, the Death Egg stuff and all that shit if you want to. Put in the Chaos Emeralds and Super Sonic as a mechanic in the levels the way that was in those old games, but, like, figure out a new 3D game with that, a new story to tell, and then you make Sonic the Hedgehog 3, and then you can put Knuckles in it. Do not reboot Sonic the Hedgehog and then just put every single Sonic character that has ever existed and just dump them into that game, plus your 5 new Sonic characters that you want to make. Like, if you're going to redo Sonic and, like, reboot Sonic and try to reinvent Sonic for 2016, which I do not think that they have ever really rethought their approach to Sonic since Sonic Adventure, basically. Like, the Sonic the Hedgehog that exists now is a Sonic the Hedgehog that was last updated in the early 2000s. And they've never, like, I guess, like, Sonic Boom, they tried to redo the art stuff, but they've never gone back to the character and kind of, like, tried to rethink what is a Sonic the Hedgehog character that would appeal to kids today. And, like, what, like, and he still feels, like, super dated and super 90s to me. Like, that's what I want. Like, reboot the character and find the heart of that character again and, like, bring it out and, like, cut off all the extraneous bullshit.
I agree. I think that would be good. Now, what do you think they'll actually do?
Oh, I mean, they're going to make Sonic Boom 2. Or, okay, like, whatever, like, how they're going to title these games.
Okay.
Like, that's what's going to happen. And
they've
then,
made a couple of them already. You might have not even noticed.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they've been making some, like, 3DS games or whatever, that kind of bullshit. And, like, they're going to do that. Like, I think that TV show that was renewed for a second season, then when that TV show gets canceled, they will reboot Sonic the Hedgehog and make it terrible and make it completely different. It's like, just, like, throw out everything, get a different studio in there, and just, like, redesign Sonic again, but, like, throw in all these fucking characters and all this bullshit, make it completely incomprehensible, and they have no idea what they're doing.
So do you think Sonic's just kind of dead?
I think so. Like, I think he doesn't have to be. I think there's more than enough room to, like, get in there and fix stuff. Because it's like, you know, because, like, we're still making fucking, like, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies and shit like that. Like, these kinds of characters can be rebooted and redone over and over and over again for different, like, for new generations and different markets, and that's fine. I just feel like Sega has shown time and time again that they don't know what to do with Sonic, and they're not particularly interested in trying to do something big with Sonic.
Yeah.
Like, Sega has moved into being, like, a much bigger publisher of games than they are of developers, and that's been like that for a while. You know, like, they've acquired Atlus and stuff like that. I just feel like Sega's in a very different place as a company, and they just don't seem interested in trying to put a huge amount of energy into Sonic the Hedgehog. They're just doing whatever is the easiest thing to do with him.
All right, one last question.
Okay.
How would you feel if they didn't use Eggman and they didn't call him Dr. Robotnik, but they called him Dr. Robobot?
I think that would be a disaster. I think we would have to burn it all down. I think Sega would have to dissolve as a company. I think I would have to like give back all my Sonic the Hedgehog games, because it's like, what the fuck are you doing? What is a fucking Robobot?